And Chair, the floor is yours.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock and we will open the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control meeting, a board meeting of August the 11th. And we will start with Chris, will you please call the roll?
Sorry, working on it. Dr. Barbanel?
Here.
Mr. Anderson?
Here.
Ms. Blair? Not here yet. Dr. Olson?
Here.
Mr. Strawn?
Here.
There he is. Yeah. Ms. Warren? I see her. Chair Cantu?
Here.
I'm present as well, Chris. Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you. We have a quorum. Roger Mitchell, would you please give the opening statement providing instructions on how to participate in this remote meeting?
Absolutely. Good morning. My name is Roger Mitchell, and I am a supervising engineering geologist with the San Diego Water Board. Today, I am serving as the remote meeting coordinator and would like to share some instructions on how to participate in today's virtual board meeting. If you wish to make a verbal comment during the public forum or during one of the board agenda items, you must be signed in to the Zoom webinar or be participating by phone. If you are currently watching the webcast on calspan.org and you want to comment on an agenda item, you'll need to register to sign into the Zoom webinar or call into the meeting. Information on how to participate can be found on the San Diego Water Board's meeting agenda website. Public comments will be accepted for each item after all presentations for the items are complete. If you wish to speak on an item, please virtually raise your hand. If you are using a computer or tablet, please use the raise hand button in Zoom. If you're calling into Zoom, please dial *9 to raise your hand. Please use the raise a hand feature to let the board know if you wish to speak, even if you previously registered and indicated that you wish to speak on an item. If you do not raise your hand, we will assume that you no longer wish to speak. When public comments start on an item, the comment order will be determined by the order each person raised their hand. I will call on each commenter by name, or if you are on the phone, I will call the last three digits of your phone number. And then I will unmute each person when it is their turn to speak. Please note, you will not appear by video during your testimony. There is a 3-minute time limit for each public commenter. However, that time could be extended at the chair's discretion. During public testimony, you will see a timer on the screen for those calling in by phone. We will run the timer and let you know when you have 30 seconds left and when your time is up. I would like to remind everyone participating in the board meeting today to state your name for the record before you speak, and please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. If you experience any technical difficulties, please call or text to area code 805-801-3676 or email it@agtvideo.com. Thank you.
If I could make one minor correction, the phone number is 805-801-3576. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger, and thank you, Bob. At this point, any member of the public may address and ask questions of the board relating to any matter within the San Diego Water Board's jurisdiction, provided that matter is not on the agenda or pending before the San Diego Water Board. Roger, do we have any speakers for our public forum?
Yes, we do. We have Mike Beaman.
Mr. Beaman, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, board. And my name is Mike Beaman, Laguna Bluebell Coalition. I have a brief slide presentation. If we could display that, please.
I am pulling it up now.
Thank you. Good to see everybody.
Excuse me, there's a small difficulty here.
Yes, and I'll keep it under 3 minutes. Next slide, please. Next slide. Thank you. On many summer days, a naturally occurring Aliso Beach sandburn provides safe public access to all beach areas for hundreds of visitors fleeing inland heat waves. Next slide, please. These slides show the amount of traffic on the berm. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. As of last Saturday, this was the traffic on the berm. And if you look closely up in the photo, you can see there's hundreds of people further up the beach that use the berm as a bridge. Next slide, please. The next morning, the berm was breached at 8 a.m. Notice the height of the people and the depth of the berm is probably at least 10 feet. Next slide, please. This is how it is breached, simply with a trench and a shovel. Next slide, please. 2.5 million gallons of urban runoff, equivalent to 4 Olympic swimming pools, are released at each breaching event. You can see some of the contaminated particles. Next slide, please. Unpermitted breaching of the naturally occurring Aliso Beach sandburn continues on average one time per week throughout the 9-month summer season and often twice per week or more. So a rough calculation of 2.5 million gallons over 36 weeks equals about 100 million gallons of urban runoff that is going into the beach this summer. Thank you. Next slide, please. Rapidly collapsing banks can sweep children out to sea. Next slide, please. The community has worked diligently to educate the public about the problems at Aliso Beach, and we're about nearing the 1-year anniversary of our request for enforcement. Next slide, please. Surf rider and OC coastkeeper have joined the effort. And one of the visitors to the beach said he was happy the water board was taking a look at the issue. And he captures what a lot of us feel. It's essential, he said, that the pandemic beaches are a sanctuary. If you're causing more pollution and making it hazardous for people, you're taking away the sanctuary and peacefulness. If it's presenting a public health risk, it needs to be addressed. Next slide, please. Orange County has beach berm jurisdiction above the red mean high tide line. And you can see that clearly. This was their Army Corps of Engineer application. Next slide, please. When will the Regional Board investigative order be complete for enforcement? Since there's been no timely investigative order to find enforcement, the public is beginning to feel that it's okay to pollute the ocean, cut off safe public access to all beaches, and ignore the state water quality regulations. When will enforcement begin? No justice means more pollution for our community. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Beeman. We have heard of this before. I understand Lori Walsh of our staff can answer our questions and give us a status report. Ms. Walsh, are you available? There you are.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the board. Currently, Water Board staff has taken a look at the information that Orange County and OC Parks provided in response to our investigative order. They did respond to all our questions in a timely manner. We have consulted with our legal counsel on this matter as well, and we currently are planning to we're planning it right now as we speak to reach out to Mr. Beenan, perhaps join him in the field, myself, Helen Yu, and Dave Gibson to discuss this matter. We have looked at all the technical information and really it determined that the human health aspect of these releases are not the problem. We've recognized in reviewing the technical data that there's other beneficial uses in terms of ecosystem health that we are working with our monitoring and research unit on, and also collaborating with the folks that are involved in the restoration project in the area, as well as U.S. Fish and Wildlife and California Fish and Wildlife. So we are definitely continuing our efforts in this area and going to be reaching out to Mr. Beenin this week, actually. The timing of the meeting was kind of interesting in terms of that. So we will be reaching out to Mr. Beenin today or tomorrow, actually. So,
thank you, Ms. Walsh. So, Mr. Beenin, your presentation was very timely. Thank you very much. And we'd like to hear in the future how things are going and what the result of this investigative order is.
Thank you to the board for pursuing this. And keep in mind, urban runoff is still declared a public health risk after storms. And there's no reason to believe that this water is any different than storm water. So, but also there's the public access issue. So thank you very much for the time to update on this important issue to our community.
Thank you. Roger, do we have any other speakers for public forum?
Or chair, we do not.
Thank you very much. We'll move on to our board business. We will consider adoption of the board meeting minutes of June the 9th. Do I have a motion to approve them as submitted?
No, ma'am.
Thank you, Ms. Warren. A second? Thank you, Dr. Olson. We have a second. Any discussion on the minutes? Will the clerk call the roll, please?
Dr. Barbanel?
Aye.
Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Aye.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
And Chair Kenton?
Thank you. Under reports, we're really thrilled to introduce and invite our new State Water Board liaison, Nicole Morgan. Ms. Morgan is a new appointee to the State Water Board. We've invited her to not just give us a report, but to tell us a little bit about herself so we can get to know her. Our Executive Officer Gibson and I had a chance to meet with her virtually earlier, and we're really delighted to have her. So if she is on the line, we'll start with her and then we'll follow with board member updates after that.
Good morning, Chair and members of the board. I'm happy to be here this morning. So before I give my liaison report, I'll give a short introduction and see if you guys have any questions for me. So again, good morning. I am Nicole Morgan. I am the region's new liaison. I was appointed to the State Water Board in June, and prior to becoming a board member, I was an assistant deputy director with the State Water Board's Division of Financial Assistance. I have been with the water boards for about 12 years and have worked for both the state and the Central Valley Regional Water Boards. While with the Central Valley Regional Board, I was the NPDES Compliance and Enforcement Unit Senior and was lucky enough to also be their NPDES Program Manager. During my time at the State Water Board, I worked in the Office of the Delta Water Master, Division of Water Rights, and for the Division of Financial Assistance. Prior to joining the water boards, I worked in private consulting, designing drinking water distribution and wastewater conveyance and treatment facilities. I started my career at the Sacramento Regional County Sanitation District's wastewater treatment facility as a design engineer. And my hope is that my diverse background will enable me to have a holistic approach in this new position. So I'll pause there and see if there's any questions.
Congratulations on your appointment and a warm welcome. One thing I'd like to note is Ms. Morgan requested the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board to be in her portfolio. So we are extra lucky there and we are looking forward to working with her.
And thank you. I'm really thrilled to, have received this assignment and to get to know you all and work with the region. So if there's no further questions, I can go ahead and give my liaison report and please feel free to ask questions there too. So let's see here. There has been quite a bit going on. So for drought preparedness and response, if you haven't already, please check out the State Water Board's drought website. It provides information on regional drought responses, the Water Board's actions, financial assistance, and reporting tools. Please review the webpage and send your feedback to drought@waterboards.ca.gov. On August 2nd, the State Board issued curtailment orders to 861 water right holders in the upper Russian River. On August 3rd, the State Water Board adopted an emergency curtailment regulation for the Delta watershed. The emergency regulation must be approved by the Office of Administrative Law and filed with the Secretary of State before it becomes effective and curtailment orders can be issued. Of the 6,600 water right holders in the Delta watershed, approximately 5,700 could be ordered to curtailment diversions as early as this month under the authority provided by the regulation. The remainder who hold older water rights or riparian rights could be subject to curtailment if conditions worsen. On July 16th, staff released an emergency regulation for the Scott River and Shasta River watersheds, and public comments are due on July 23rd. The comment period ends on August 12th. On August 17th, the State Water Board will consider emergency regulation for adoption. So there's also a new program, the California Water and Wastewater Arrears Payment Program. The State Water Board is developing the program to distribute $1 billion in relief to reduce customer water bills as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. In early August, the State Water Board opened a survey for community water systems to inform the funding allocation and program eligibilities. On August 19th, so that's next Thursday, staff will provide an overview of the program. For water quality, there's statewide registration order. It establishes a streamlined permit process for specific types of environmentally beneficial restoration activities. On June 30th, the State Board released a proposed order and draft environmental impact report for public comment. On August 4th, the Water Board held a public hearing to hear oral comments. The comment period ends on August 13th. Let's see here. The statewide construction stormwater general permit, it regulates stormwater discharges associated with construction activities disturbing one or more acres. The State Water Board adopted the existing permit in 2009, which has since expired and has been administratively extended until the permit is reissued. On May 28th, the board released the proposed statewide EPS construction general permit for a 60-day public comment period. On June 9th and June 10th of this year, staff held two public workshops to discuss the content of the proposed permit reissuance. On August 4th, the State Board held a public hearing to hear oral comments, and that comment period ends on August 13th. So again, under the for Division of Financial Assistance, there's additional funding for water infrastructure projects. So on August 18th, the State Water Board will discuss the water infrastructure funding plan. It's an allocation of $1.385 billion to the State Water Board. The particular item that will be in front of the board will be proposes authorities for the Division of Financial Assistance to administer $200 million of the funds and $100 million for drinking water projects and $100 million for wastewater projects through existing funding programs. Additionally, the item proposes to authorize CFA to transfer $50 million of the water recycling funding appropriated for the Pure for San Diego's North City project. Let's see here. So then also on August 6th, the State Board released the draft 2021-22 Fund Expenditure Plan for the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund. On August 18th, the State Board will discuss the plan at a board workshop. Public comment period ends on August 27th. The Safer Advisory Group advises the Water Board and Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund Expenditure Plan and other related safer policies. On July 6th, the Safer Advisory Group application window opened. On August 4th, staff held a Safer Advisory Group public workshop, and the application period ends on August 31st. On August 12th, the State Board and Safer Advisory Group will hold a public meeting to discuss the needs assessment and the fund expenditure plan. So that was a lot. So I apologize for that long report. There's a lot going on.
No apologies are necessary. There is a lot going on in every corner of the state of California when it comes to water and climate change impact. So all of those things that you mentioned are germane to that, and it is all very necessary. Any questions for board member, State Board Member Morgan?
Okay, not hearing any or seeing any raised hands, please feel free to reach out with questions. That's what I'm here for. Happy to answer them at any time, and looking forward to working with you all.
Thank you very much. We look forward to working with you. One of the things I'd like to comment on is, in the very beginning, Board Member Morgan reported on the curtailments. We have had curtailments previously, but I don't think ever this widespread or this deep. People are really, really feeling the pain of the drought. 50 of our 58 counties in California are now declared under a drought emergency, and we're all in the same bathtub. The governor has requested a voluntary 15% reduction throughout California in our water use. And I would really like to emphasize that we really need to step up and achieve that 15% reduction from 2020 baselines. So the San Diego region generally gets about 50% of their water imported from the Colorado River. The Colorado River and the dams are nearing the point that triggers the automatic curtailments and deliveries from Colorado River. So we are, that is a long-term deep drought. And about 30% of our imports come from Northern California, which is feeling the drought most directly and severely. And about 20% are local supplies. So we've grown that 20%. It used to be smaller. So we're moving in the right direction. And that's really necessary. And there's been tremendous investments made to allow that to happen. But we still have, on average, about 70% to 80% of our total water budget is imported from two areas that are in severe drought. So while our county, the County of San Diego and Southern Orange County and Riverside, where we serve, are not experiencing a drought themselves, our sources of water are experiencing a severe drought. So that 15% voluntary reduction is really important to focus on. Last call for comments or questions for Board Member Morgan. Okay, thank you so much. We look forward to seeing you always. We'll open the floor now for board members for questions, announcements, comments, etc. Dr. Olson.
Okay, I'm not muted. Sorry, I cut myself up. I just wanted to say a few things about South Orange County, which is the area that I'm from, to give you a little bit of an idea about what's going on. So the whole county has not enforced, but certainly encouraged many public airways announcements on the 15% recommended cutback. And the Bureau of Rec Funds have been acquired for a reclamation project. South Coast Desal got some funds from the federal government. And Celeste and I also had a meeting with a tribal meeting this week or last week, and I'll let Celeste describe it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Announcements, comments, concerns, recommendations, insights? Well, I'll start with the tribal meeting. We had a good meeting last August the 4th from 1 to 3:30. It was what we called the Tribal Summit Agenda, and it was the basis for starting the conversation about the regional plan, basin plan review. And our discussion was how would the tribal chairs and their staff like to interact with our regional board concerning the development of beneficial uses for cultural tribal beneficial uses. We had a robust discussion. We had some technical difficulties in the beginning. We were able to get through that, luckily. We really were benefited from a presentation from Michael Connolly, who is well known and is very informative about the history of cultural tribal beneficial uses. And we took a lot of feedback. Our board, our staff, Jody Epson gave a report on what our timeline will be and how we might best interact together. So a lot of that is developmental, and it's still developing. And this will be the first, I think, of many points of connections with the tribal leadership and their staff. So I want to thank Dr. Olson for joining me. I thought it was a good meeting. Thank you very much. And stay tuned for the future meetings, because I think they're very interesting, and I always learn a lot, and I appreciate that opportunity, and I think you would also. Also in the, Dave, do you want to add anything to that? I see you popped in.
No, thank you, Chair Cantu. I also thought it was a very good meeting, and it was a follow-up to the meeting that we had last year. And this meeting was specifically on the subject of the train review and other subjects that the tribes wanted to share with us. I think that it was a very graciously received opportunity by the tribes, and I think it helped inform us in several key respects with regard to our triennial review process.
Thank you. I also want to draw everyone's attention, including the public's, of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recent report that was released, I think, 2 days ago, known affectionately as the IPCC report. This is an international group of climate change scientists who come to a consensus as to where we are relative to climate change. And the report they issued earlier this week is really very, very alarming. I have an executive summary designed for policymakers. I'd like to share that with everybody. So I'll send that out at the end of the meeting. And I think that's something we should focus on. Water is affected. It's almost the greatest expression of climate change in California is first on water. We're also seeing it in fire. We are in the second largest fire of all times. Much of our state is on fire. We have air quality impacts throughout the West from those fires. And of course, we're all very aware of the deep drought that we're experiencing. Those are just some of the climate change impacts, but it's fast and furious at this point. And I thought the IPCC report would be particularly helpful as we think about framing this issue going forward. I know Henry Bobardal is very tuned into these issues, and I'd like to invite you if you have any comments on this particular report, Henry.
Not really, thank you.
Okay. Well, look for that in your inboxes a little bit after this meeting. There's always every once in a while a chance for a celebration, and we have the Sustained Superior Accomplishments Awards today. So I'm very pleased to be able to present those to Daniel Boyd, Tom Alo, and Lara Quintin. I don't know exactly how to pronounce her name, and let me Here we go, get my little cheat sheet. And so a little bit about them and why they are being presented the Superior Accomplishment Award. During this last year, especially, they have gone above and beyond to make contributions that have benefits not only to the San Diego region, but also to the site cleanup program work across the state. Individually and collectively, each of them displayed an excellent attitude and extraordinary commitment to the hard work of protecting water quality in the San Diego Bay. Strong project ownership and a spirit for focusing on achieving tangible environmental outcomes. The San Diego Water Board is grateful for the contributions and commitment of Mr. Allo, Ms. Quintine, and Mr. Boyd, especially during the pandemic conditions of the last 18 months. So please join me in like a round of applause. I hope we can, oh, I see Tom is there. I'm not sure we can see everybody, but thank you very much. You have certificates that you will receive if you haven't already received them. And these things are very important and we really appreciate you doing this work. At this point, I'll invite our executive officer to respond to any board members' questions regarding his written office, executive officer's report, which was quite extensive, as always.
I had a quick question about the meeting with the Lake San Marcos stakeholders. I wanted to know if someone who was there would mind sort of summarizing or speaking to the sentiment of the crowd, whether we're meeting their needs. They've certainly been very interactive with the board over the years, and I just like to have like a flavor of how the meeting went, if that's possible. Thank you.
This is Sarah Miron, site cleanup program manager, and I was in attendance at the meeting. Laura Cretton is also on the line, and she was also running the meeting. It was very well received. We didn't get that many specific questions at the meeting. We have gotten some follow-up questions from members of the community association, and they sort of have a liaison group for water quality, and they've been asking for regular updates from us. And I believe Laura has been in contact with them this week on that topic. Laura, is there anything you wanted to add specifically on that?
So I think I'm in regular contact with the Lake San Marcos Community Association, I would say pretty much once a month or so. They're very much involved and curious to know how the project is moving forward. They also are very helpful in spreading out some news about the Lake San Marcos project in general to their residents and whoever is on their mailing list, which is really, really nice of them to spread the word whenever we have a news. And Ms. Warren, I will also invite you to read, if it's not done yet, the executive officer's report. I think there was a summary of this meeting on May 6th. So if you have any further questions, I'm here to answer.
So thank you. I did read the report. I wanted to know, you know, your guys' take on how they felt about how we're communicating and whether we're being responsive enough. And it sounds like we are, hopefully. I will note the one calendar item that I thought was missing from sort of the items you all have laid out very clearly is when this item will next be before the board.
That's something that we haven't really thought about much lately, I think. We've been waiting for a lot of large documents and the installation of the aeration system to be completed. So the aeration system did get installed earlier this spring. They're not going to be able to start it, I believe, until maybe January or so. And Laura has been reviewing the first version of their corrective action plan for the lake cleanup and mitigation. So I think it makes sense to get a little bit further down that path before we have an update. But possibly I would have to discuss this with Roger Mitchell, but possibly later this year, agenda scheduling allowing.
Thank you, Board Member Warren. Just to add a little bit more to that, there have been a couple of key steps that we have taken in recent months to move us towards scheduling a board action on Lake San Marcos. One of them I withdrew from the participation agreement on behalf of the board. There is a process entailed in all of that, which is still wending its way. We may be scheduling an item on that decision. That clears the way for the water board to utilize other tools in its regulatory box, such as cleanup and abatement orders on the lake. I believe we have heard very clearly from the board their frustration that it has taken so very long to get to this point. And I myself look at the report and I'm a little bit discouraged that after more than 10 years on this, we won't have a corrective action plan final until 2023. And so where we can, we will try to move this forward more expeditiously and more determinatively. There will be concerns on both sides of that. And there's a process that we have to follow in terms of enforcement procedures. And while we're doing all of this, Sarah's team is also working on Lockheed Martin case down in Mission San Diego Bay and a few other cases. So this is definitely in a second tier of issues for us while we work on San Diego Bay and some environmental justice issues in the site cleanup unit that I'll mention in a few moments during my presentation on item four. But we are very much aware of the board's concern that we move forward now and address the many homeowners and public's concerns about the condition of Lake San Marcos that we've been hearing about for many years now.
Henry, I see your hand.
Dave, you, in your executive report, which I guess we're coming to, you mentioned the possibility of enforcement actions. What do you have in mind? What can we do? And when can we do it?
Thank you, Henry. We're considering several options, and I want to be very general at this point so it doesn't appear that we're having a hearing on the subject. But we are looking at a time schedule order for some activities and a cleanup and abatement order for some activities. Those are just a couple of our options that are available that would drive the process forward. And in the case of the time schedule order, perhaps expedite some of the process that the dischargers want to pursue. But our goal is to attain healthy waters in Lake San Marcos for recreational use and for the protection of public health, not to expedite or make their business plan effective. So there are a couple of options available to us, but the first key step was for us to withdraw from the participation agreement, which we have done. There are protests from several of the municipalities in that agreement with us that we may be bringing to you at a later date.
So, Dave, has there ever been an evaluation of the economic and personal impact on the residents of Lake San Marcos of the 10-year, I don't know what to call it, hiatus on solving their problems?
Even more like 21 years, Henry, because it was one of my very first meetings I took.
10.
It's one of the very first meetings I took when I joined the Water Board as an environmental scientist in 2000. So yes, and I'm not aware that there has ever been such an evaluation done. Perhaps
is
Sarah...
Is it within the board's purview to do such a thing?
I don't know that it is, but I'd like to ask Sarah and Laura if the remedial plan addressed this issue at all. The RIFS, I believe it's called.
Yeah, the RIFS, which was finalized in 2016, did include an aspect of economic analysis, but that focused on the preferred mitigative actions. Laura, is there anything in the new corrective action plan that you've looked at that has any sort of economic analysis?
No, like as Sarah said, we just received the Lake Corrective Action Plan recently and I have reviewed it and there's nothing in terms of the economics. It just refers back to the RIFS report that Sarah just said was finalized in 2016.
So Dave, there seems to be some analysis of the impact of this, if I understood what Sarah said. Remedying that be put into an enforcement action?
Yes, Henry, we would absolutely take note of that. I think though, unless I'm mistaken, and Laura can correct me, I think that that probably refers more to the cost of compliance than it does to the potential effects or economic impacts to the residents themselves, except as they might help contribute to the cost of compliance. But we would absolutely take note of that or other information that might be available in the findings of fact that the board would consider in adopting a cleanup and abatement order, for example, as just as one hypothetical example.
So if we were sitting together with members of the public who live in Lake San Marcos, what recommendation could we give them about remedying the losses that they may have suffered over the last two decades because of the mismanagement of Lake San Marcos?
I would suggest, Henry, that they first and foremost talk to the lake owner themselves, and then to the other parties in the agreement that we just withdrew from, who have been in litigation with one another over how to carry the costs of compliance and address the conditions of the lake, and make it clear to them that they would rather see action than planning. We've been spending a lot of time on planning, and in some respects that's necessary, but making a specious expectations of Army Corps to issue no permit letter and then waiting more than a year for that no permit letter when they could have applied for the permit is just one example of the things that have delayed movement forward on this issue. So going forward, I'd like to dedicate the staff's time, besides working on other cases like the tow basin cleanup and abatement order and dry cleaners in environmental justice communities, to move forward now on an action that will get results. We've had lots of talk and planning, and perhaps the board imposing some requirements, hypothetically speaking, will move things forward more efficiently and more timely than seems to be presented in our current report and update today. Certainly our patience is at an end.
Thank you.
Dr. Betty Olson is next.
So I'd like to ask about, you have some tables and figures in the back that deal with issues in wastewater. And one of the figures that you have talks about the total volume of public treatment or public treatment plant spills. Now, is Tijuana included in that final figure? Not, we know that, I know you call it out in tables, but that final graph or figure that just shows the total volume is, I'm sorry, it's the South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant. Is that system included in those volumes of overflows?
I see that Keith Yeager is ready to give us an answer.
Oh, good. Thank you.
So there's actually a separate report for transboundary flows. So that that report does not include any spills from or any transboundary flows from the South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant.
Okay, so it seemed to me some of the numbers were pretty high. All right. So do you have, I mean, what's happening? Why is that? Because it's been sort of dry. I don't.
So there was some larger spills earlier in the year. I think April had some large spills. From my recollection, I think City of San Diego had a 12 million gallon spill and Oceanside had a 1.2 million gallon spills. So that's kind of driving those volumes in that figure.
So the figure was in millions of gallons and you had 1,000 million gallons.
So it's total per month. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's still a bit big number, 1,000.
Maybe. Million. I'll take it back.
Unless I misread it, but could you take a look at that and just let me know? And if I'm misreading it, please also let me know that. I just think if it's that large, we want to be paying, or at least bringing it up more publicly and asking people to do something about it. Thanks, Sen.
Yeah, I'll double check the numbers, but there were some large spills in April that kind of drive those numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
I really appreciate Dr. Olson putting a spotlight on this because spills do happen, but they are largely preventable with aggressive preventive maintenance. And I mean, generally you get spills because of blockages or roots and things that if you do aggressive jetting and cleaning, you are able to avoid. And the part that I find alarming is not only do we see really big spills, but a volume of pollution that was able to get to a receiving water where they weren't able to intercept it in advance. So that's what really upsets me. But I do see it is alarming. So thank you very much, Dr. Olson, for bringing that up. Any other questions regarding the executive officer's report?
Plus, I just have one more. On the it's attachment B2 to the report on the WDRs. So it looks like there's a bunch of folks who didn't re-up for their re-enroll in their third party group for the ag waivers. But I'm just wondering if it stuck out because there were so many people, and I know how hard staff has worked to bring people up to speed, to be communicative, and to reach out to constituents. So I'm just wondering if we think this is a one-off, if this has particularly to do with the dissolution of that particular group, or whether we're seeing kind of like a fall off of interest or paying attention to the program, getting everything that's going on in the world. I'm sure there's someone available to speak to that point. It just stuck out in terms of the number of folks listed for enforcement actions.
Yes, it did. Roger.
Yes, Board Member Warren. I believe that it's the decrease is just associated with the dissolution of the monitoring group that we had. We do typically see that there's a fluctuation in enrollments, but I think overall the trend that we're currently seeing is that we're continuing to see enrollments and continuing to do outreach and working with the other monitoring groups that we have, as well as individuals, to help them stay enrolled, or to enroll and then to stay enrolled into the ag order. These dips, we have experienced those before with enrollment as we've been working forward on enrollment. But that's what I would attribute that dip to.
In the meantime, Board Member Warren, we are recruiting aggressively to fill the position in the large shoes left vacant by Christina Arias's rotation over to enforcement. And we have been continuing the enforcement focus on this. I recently acted on behalf of the board and accepted a settlement offer from one of the farmers who had not enrolled. So we are keeping up the pressure and the outreach on both sides as much as possible to try to maintain this. Losing the Duluth group was unfortunate, and there was, I think, a lag, as Roger indicated, in people moving over to one of the other groups to fill in the time. And of course, the times we live in, more than a few people are suffering financially and may simply have looked at the fees and decided later rather than now. And again, I think we are compassionate enough to understand that, while we also expect in the fullness of time that they will move over to one of the groups and engage properly there.
I think our region is the most challenging, in my opinion, in the state of California, because we have so many tiny, almost, you know, mom and pop farmers who don't have, they're not of the magnitude where they have professional staff that, you know, takes care of these kinds of permitting issues. They do everything themselves, and it's really challenging. They're very, very small. I think we have a number comes to me, 10,000 farms with the average size of less than 10 acres. I don't know if I'm remembering those numbers correctly. I'm sure Eric can jump in and let me know, or else Dave. Yeah, Eric, please.
Farms. I think it's 6,000 farms.
But 6,000.
Large number of farms. One of the largest counties in the nation for a number of small farmers.
Yeah, so we have 6,000 farms with an average of less than 10 acres, where some other regions might have 10 farms with an average of 6,000 acres. So the multiplicity of relationships is really quite taxing. Great. So are we ready to move into consent calendar?
If I may, Chair, I have a couple of things to share. First of all, I'd like to ask the board to join me in congratulating Charles Chain on the occasion of his retirement after 25 years. Charles is, I think, one of the first five people at the Water Board I ever met. And so we're really glad to congratulate him on his retirement. And also, on the other side of the equation, to welcome our newest member of our staff, Misha Myers, who's joined us as a student assistant in the Groundwater Sustainability and Protection Unit. And she's here with us today. So we're very glad to have her services. Even during these trying times working teleworking, we're able to keep students actively engaged and give them those opportunities both to learn and to assist our program staff. If it may please the board, I'd like to give the board a very brief verbal update on the USMCA Eligible Public Entities Coordination Group. process. I would have put this in the written report, but the meeting was literally last Wednesday on the 4th when this report was already going up for the ADA compliance review. And what I can do instead is I will share a screen and share with you that the EPA was looking in the course of this process with a $300 million allocated and authorized by Congress at initially 10 projects. They organized those 10 projects into 12 project grouping alternatives, multiple projects in each alternative. And in the course of that analysis, I've whittled it down to three alternatives for optimization, as they call it. They won't say preferred alternatives, but they're optimizing these three. They are alternative I, the comprehensive alternative, alternative H, which is essentially optimizing wastewater infrastructure for Tijuana's benefit, and alternative E2, a hybrid of those that includes some of the measures that the Water Board and City of Imperial Beach and others have insisted upon, like a river diversion, and some that have not. The comprehensive alternative is the do-it-once, do-it-right alternative, but that would cost $566 million when EPA has been authorized $300 million. So there's a shortfall. I directed a couple of questions to EPA regarding the ability of the North American Development Bank and Mexico itself at the state, federal, and local level to make up some of that difference, and if there are other funding mechanisms at EPA's discretion to make up that difference. Because we would be able to achieve a 76%, and that's a conservative estimate, of transboundary flow day reductions, and over a 95% reduction of beach impairments being a function both of river flows and also of discharges south of the border at several locations, but most notably Punta Mandara, where wastewater from the non-operational San Antonio de los Buenos wastewater treatment plant currently discharges directly onto the shoreline. And a little later in the day today, you're going to hear a presentation from Margarita Diaz on monitoring along the coast that bears that out. We can look to that issue also with data from Scripps Institution of Oceanography, which has done plume tracking and modeling of onshore currents. And most recently, the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project published a paper, of which Margarita is one of the authors, documenting the genetic markers that they've used to track wastewater. And so the answer is very clear. Yes, indeed, raw wastewater from several locations south of the border does make its way north, as far north as Coronado. And so the comprehensive solution really is necessary. But 60 years of Water Board experience on this subject also shows that the transboundary flows in the river itself are an important issue, and we desperately need to have the kind of management measure alternatives there that we take for granted right now on the canyon collectors. They may not be perfect, they may not capture everything, and they're not designed to capture wet weather flows, but they do offer the kind of flexibility and responsiveness for transboundary flows that we would suffer without. The Matadero Canyon impoundment, for example, we were able to capture and divert most of that 530 cubic meters of wastewater because of the Smuggler's Gulch Canyon collector. Only during the rainy days did we lose that. I see your hand, Henry, and if you'll bear with me for just a moment, I want to summarize a little bit further. I did also indicate on the board's behalf that we do not place a high priority on alternative H. While it would benefit Tijuana enormously and would help address the San Antonio flows by redirecting all that wastewater to the South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant, it doesn't give us the kind of ability to address transboundary flows in the rivers or any better in the canyons than we currently have. And alternative E2, I acknowledged, was perhaps a useful compromise if there simply isn't any other money forthcoming or any way to phase it in on the Mexico side. It does at least give us, again, a very conservative reduction of 64% of transboundary flow days and a 63% of coastal beach days. But it is a compromise. The comprehensive alternative is one that the Water Board has joined Imperial Beach and others speaking out on. I recently did an interview with KUSI where I attempted to hammer home that point. Let's do it once. Let's do it right. And let's try to find a way to make the comprehensive alternative the one that is actually eventually identified. The last key point I wanted to share with you is it is at least concerning, although I think it is understandable, that EPA has not simply pointed to one and said, there it is, that's our preferred alternative. The environmental evaluation process has a lot of nuances and legal specifications to it that make it that they have to evaluate a range of alternatives and then select one after the analysis is done rather than select one at the front end. But I did point out that the Water Board and several other parties on the EPECG have just received a stipulated stay from federal court on the basis of being able to find out from this process what the preferred alternatives are, and are they a basis for discussion and settlement, or if they're a basis for us to resume litigation. And that time runs out in February, and EPA is not expecting to identify a final alternative until mid-2022 in this process. So they are aware of that and assured me that there will be communications forthcoming, as I've previously reported on their behalf, that will perhaps clarify things for the parties in litigation and currently in stay to consider. So thank you very much for your forbearance, Henry. What question can I answer?
No problem. Thank you very much for the report. I would like to say that it's not the EPA that has the money, it's the Congress. And if the Congress, our congressional delegation, could be thoroughly apprised of the fact that the $300 million, which I totally admire their having gotten, is not enough, that might actually move them to get the $566 million or whatever the comprehensive cost is, and that we shouldn't be shy about asking for it because the EPA presently doesn't have it.
Yes, so Congress did authorize and allocate the money, and you'll be glad to know that all of the congressional delegations, as well as both U.S. senators' staffs, were on the EPECG meeting, and then subsequently attended the public meeting on Friday. So they got a chance to see this information and hear from myself and other stakeholders, as well as members of the public, how important this is. And yes, we are very grateful to our congressional delegation for moving this forward and bringing us the kind of money we could never even have imagined 10 years ago to actually begin resolving this long-standing
dilemma.
Dave,
were the members of Congress involved in these meetings? Not their staff, the members.
Scott Peters was present at one of the previous meetings. I don't know that he was present physically or virtually at this one or the others. I did see comments specifically from the several of their staff.
So let me remind you that when the $300 million came about, the Congress members held a press conference implying that $300 million was the solution. I think that if we want to be good stewards of the Tijuana River Valley, and more precisely under our authority, the citizens of the United States living just north of the border in Imperial Beach and other communities, we need to get together with the members of Congress, not just their staffs.
Indeed.
And I would not present them this chart because I don't know where the number 76% comes from. And further, I don't know what the uncertainty in that is. Is that plus or minus 10% or plus or minus 30%? I mean, I can't understand from the chart, and maybe the information is not available, but I don't know what to do with this chart.
Yes, Henry, there's a lot of detail behind this, and error bars and such were not provided in this. We haven't seen the details of their analysis, how they came up with 76. I do think that when it comes to the transboundary flows, those numbers are conservative. If everything else works out exactly right as described in terms of the improvements to the sewering system in Tijuana, we should have less flows in the river on a base flow basis, and we should have fewer breaks. But that's really quite speculative, and I don't know how you approximate that in a percentage like this. Yeah. So we have asked for those kinds of details, and in this case, they actually walked us through, I think, about 50 or 60 slides on this, but they did not give us exactly that answer. And it is, I think, right now a discussion point among several of the stakeholders, especially led by Imperial Beach and the city of San Diego. The mayors are reaching out to the elected officials and are proposing to have a meeting with them to talk about some of the alternatives and options and to make their point of view available. I've asked to be kept in the loop on that. There may be an opportunity for one or more of our board members to join that conversation if invited. EPA also did indicate, though I know I do not have a schedule for you, that Jane Nishida and Radhika Fox from Washington, D.C. would be coming out to San Diego, perhaps even Michael Reagan, the administrator of EPA. But EPA has not announced any dates or times for those types of meetings.
of the 566 million in the chart, how much of that is being spent in the United States and how much of that is being spent on infrastructure in Mexico?
Yeah, nearly all of the money in the end for all three projects is spent in the United States. The primary difference is that alternative H in Mexico, we simply reroute all the pipes from San Antonio to a greatly enlarged South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant. But as you can see on the table, the capital costs for the U.S. ITP, that's the South Bay Treatment Plant,
are one
of the largest items on there. And the costs to recover and reuse wastewater in Mexico, it's not really clear how that money gets spent or where it gets spent in Mexico, because that's right now secondary and tertiary treated wastewater that's discharged to the Tijuana River for lack of better use. And so we don't know how the money would be coming from. Right now, my understanding is that the majority of the costs shared with Mexico would be work on the pipelines themselves in Mexico, about $6 million or so, maybe $15 million for the larger project range. So the distribution of money was another question I did ask about, and we don't have a lot of details. EPA indicated they're having extensive negotiations with agencies in Mexico. And we were made aware at this meeting that there's been a significant transition in governance in Mexico. In the last days of Governor Bonilla's administration, they transferred responsibility, at least for wastewater, but I think also for water, from CESP, the state agency, to the city of Tijuana. And we're not sure how that transition plays out, whether the funding in the city of Tijuana is adequate, whether EPA has an effective partner at this point in time to talk with about these types of projects. It is, as always, extremely complex. And so that reinforced the message that Mayor Dedina and I emphasize, which is comprehensive solution, alternative I, is the best design for us in the River Valley. It gives us 60 million gallon per day treatment for diversion flows, and it gives us the ability to grow wastewater treatment and recycling and even offer recycled water back to Tijuana for future use, similar to what the city of San Diego is doing with their Pure Water Project. Mm-hmm. It has the most potential for us. It's not just a one-time fix that gives us a few years. It's got the most potential for future utility. And so those are messages that EPA heard from multiple stakeholders besides the Water Board. And it's a conversation that I'm absolutely confident will be continuing among the elected officials as their staff, who are very engaged, were very much present at this and previous meetings.
So I certainly agreed to the extent that I understand that graph, that the comprehensive solution is the only one that actually addresses the problems that we have heard over the years from both the citizens, the Border Patrol, and our own staff. What I don't know is whether the 566 million is a real number, is an off-the-cuff estimate, a best estimate, and I don't know that it isn't wrong by a factor of two or more, that it should be a billion. Do we know how much money in the recent infrastructure bill goes towards solving these problems?
Yeah, I don't have any information on that. The cost numbers, I think, are fairly reliable, maybe even somewhat conservative, but we don't have an error range on those from EPA. Again, that's deep details that they aren't sharing at these meetings that will probably be shared as they progress on their EIS process, but I would not expect to see that information for many months at the pace that they are currently going in.
Right. So Dave, let me make sure you understand that I share your frustration. You have been frustrated longer than I. And I don't see any end in sight. Do you really?
I do believe that there is an end in sight, Henry. I just hope that it's not the expedient end.
Okay.
while I think that it would benefit Tijuana enormously to improve their sewering system, and that is important. That's actually very important.
Right.
It really can't just be one or the other basket of eggs. We need to put them together and make it one comprehensive solution that works for Tijuana and works for San Diego. It's as a shared watershed and shared border and shared economy, we all benefit. It's definitely a win-win with the comprehensive solution, as I described it on KUSI. But the expedient solution is alternative H, because the environmental impact statement work is far smaller. They don't have to study a river diversion, for example. Customs and Border Protection spoke out in opposition to alternative I and alternative E2 because it would include river diversions and facilities that they'd be concerned about maintaining. So it is a range of opinions out there that EPA is attempting to navigate. And I do want to acknowledge that EPA has been continuously available, that they've been working truly, I think, days and nights and weekends based on the calls and the emails that I've exchanged with EPA staff at all hours of the days and nights and weekends. This is not suffering for lack of attention, but it is a very complicated process and an international one at this point to get the best outcome. But we have advocated very clearly and for alternative I that we should not have alternative or E2 or H as compromise measures if we can strive for alternative I to truly bring a solution to these issues at the border. Betty, I see your hand is up as well. How can I help?
Well, I just like to ask, so I know that in the governor's policy plan regarding water, he had a water resilience and he gave $5.1 billion, of which $1.3 billion is for drinking water and wastewater infrastructure to disadvantaged communities. Is there any way that what we're trying to do with EPA could request some of those funds?
Yeah, Betty, I think that those funds are earmarked for other projects, but I can say that EPA specifically stated that they were talking with California about cost sharing, I think, to make alternative I perhaps more affordable. But I have no specifics as to what those discussions mm-hmm. are, who's having them, or if that was anything more than speculative as one option, that it wasn't clear from their statement. I have heard that there have been discussions with the governor's office about infrastructure funding that California has or may receive that may also complement this. That would be a novel arrangement, and it may very well require a specific act of Congress as well as California legislature to authorize. But those conversations do appear to be taking place at the appropriate levels. Unfortunately, I don't get invited to those.
So could I ask, when would you hear about how that was moving forward? Or even if we're not included in those talks, is there any way that we could look at them or we could be informed of when they move forward? And the other factor would be, are the mayors and our state legislators, are they any assistance in this matter?
I think that
out to them or not?
Yes, as I described, I believe that the city of San Diego and the city of Imperial Beach are pulling together local elected officials, mayors and state legislators, county supervisor Nora Vargas and supervisor chair Nathan Fletcher have also been engaged on this as well as their staff. I will advise and update you as I learn things, but it is changing on a week by week basis going forward. And I'm not invited, unfortunately, to all of those conversations.
Okay, well, let's hope. Thank you then.
Yes.
Before we move on, I want to thank our executive officer, Dave Gibson, for his unrelenting advocacy for a comprehensive solution. And watching him in action does give me hope that we will get there. So thank you very much, Dave.
So I have one last thing. In response to Stephanie Warren's request, repeated a couple of times on lessons learned from the fires. Unfortunately, we're still learning those lessons. The fires continue. We have nonetheless asked Kimberly McMurray Cathcart and Mark Baer, engineering geologists with the Office of the Emergency Management Program at State Board, to give us a brief update. And Mark is here to share with us some of the lessons learned from the several fires that have occurred and hopefully that we're able to apply to the ones that are occurring. So I'd like to turn the floor over, if the board will bear with us, to them to give a short presentation on that and answer any of your questions. Kimberly and Mark, if you can, please take it over.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Cantu and members of the board. My name, of course, is Kimberly McMurray Cathcart. I'm a program analyst for the San Diego Water Board. I've been working with our senior staff on revisions and development to the San Diego Water Board's emergency response plans with the very capable assistance of the Emergency Management Program at the State Board. Because of this involvement with the Emergency Management Program staff, I have the very great pleasure of passing the baton now to Mark Baer, who is our official liaison from the Emergency Management Program, and he is going to enhance the information that's contained in the executive officer's report. Mark has been good enough to break away from his duties in training this morning. So Mark, if you're there, please, by all means, you have the floor.
Well, thank you very much, Kimberly. I appreciate everybody's time today and a chance to get to update you on where we stand. As Kimberly said, I am the Emergency Management Program liaison to the Region 9 Board, San Diego. I come to this with quite a bit of experience. I've worked in the environmental field for about 25 years now, in both the as a regulator in a couple of different states and in the private sector. I've done project work in about 25 states, and I've had my professional geologist license in 10 states. So I've moved around the country a lot, done a lot of emergency response work, and have brought that experience over to the board because it's something I enjoy doing, and the water board is kind of new to these sort of things. Kimberly, let me see if I can share my screen here. And I'll bring my quick little thing up. Can you see my screen now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, perfect. I'll run through some of the current situations right now. We all know last year was quite a year for fires. Well, this year, as you can see from the first set of numbers, we are already over three times further along in acreage burned than we were this time last year. We're coming up on 1 million acres already. We're tracking multiple wildfires right now. The biggest one, of course, is the Dixie Fire, which is, these are yesterday's numbers. It's actually over 500,000 acres as of this morning, with almost 900 structures destroyed. We also are tracking the Monument Fire and a couple of others. The Monument Fire, of course, and the McFarland one are the ones up in Trinity, Tehama, and Shasta counties, where the governor just yesterday issued an emergency proclamation based on that fire. We also work a lot on the drought-based stuff. As you can Miss Morgan said, you know, there's a lot going on there. The water board is responding as best they can. One of the board members pointed out that there were 50 counties in the emergency drought declaration. Right now, we have five water systems that are receiving bottled or hauled water. We're working pretty extensively with water rights due to the fact that, as was mentioned earlier, there are a lot of curtailments going on, and this is going to be causing a lot of issues up and down through there. So we're trying to step in where we can to help with that sort of thing. We also monitor all the Cal OES reports for the spills. We work with Cal EPA to get the water board updates over to them. We're reporting twice a day now to the State Operations Center on where we stand with both the fire response and the water systems that are currently experiencing outages. So we work with the Emergency Response Management Committee, which is Cal EPA's overarching emergency response organization. It has all our other BDOs in it. So one of the main things that we do when it comes to the water board is we do incident response processing. We reach out when there's a spill of any kind that's a sort of a major level. We had discussed some of the sewage spills, the Tijuana ones. We've sit in on those international commissions meetings to try and see what's going on there. One of the main things that we also do is we run a GIS system, which we use for an incident analysis. We take that and we will send that information out to the different regions when we run it. I will move forward and show you a snapshot of what that GIS tracking tool looks like. We can use it, as you can see at the top, for earthquakes, wildfires, power outages. And basically, it's a GIS tool that we pull many different layers in from. We can pull up a fire. This is an example of the Dixie Fire. We can draw a perimeter around it of, you know, anywhere from 1 to 3 to 5 miles or however big we choose. And then we can pull from the different databases. We have the CWICS for the wastewater facilities. We have CIDWIS for the drinking water facilities, the California Environmental Response System for some of the waste or the EPA stuff, the Enviro store. So we pull from a lot of different ones and we can see what sort of facilities are within that perimeter. So we can get information out to the regional boards or to other partners and say, hey, you know, you've got a certain wastewater treatment plant or a drinking water plant that's in the line of the fire. It's within a mile or 2 miles of the perimeter. That way the district engineers and some of the other people can reach out and contact that plant and say, you know, are you having any issues? Do you need emergency generators or other resources? We just brought on another water resource control engineer who is compiling a map of all the wastewater treatment plants for us. We're trying to come up with a better system of contacting them. So when things come up, an example would be last year, we worked with the EPA to come up with a emergency generator standing operating procedure guidance document. We can get that information out to them and find them the resources that they need in order to be able to respond to these sort of things. The structure of the water board, now that they've plugged us in, is kind of this. You've got your regions, divisions, and offices. When an emergency event happens, they're usually the front line that responds first. The information flows up towards the Water Board Executive Management, Cal EPA, and the State Operations Center. We see ourselves kind of as a support system for the you know, the regional boards. You guys know your water systems and your watershed better than anybody. You've got talented people that work there. So, you know, what we see ourselves doing is being able to get you the information you need, the resources you need to do the job that you're doing so well already. We also see ourselves as a point of contact, so that you don't get inundated with a lot of requests from the upper board, you know, like the executive management or Cal EPA about what's going on. We can help that information flow up and down and maintain, you know, the standard emergency management system that's set up here in California. One of the things that we've done also to support the different water boards is we've set up different training and stuff. We did conduct a training in Region 9 on the Rose Canyon Fault. We also conducted at the beginning of this year a series of lessons learned. There were four different workshops that were done. One of them was on GIS, and as you did, that's, I just touched on that. The other three were emergency funding, which, of course, as everyone knows listening to the talk about the Tijuana situation, funding is a huge issue for everybody. It's a big issue from everybody to your, from your citizen all the way up to the counties and everyone. They're looking for stuff. When a water treatment plant or a wastewater treatment plant gets destroyed or impacted, you know, they have to rebuild as quick as they can because the citizens are going to be coming back into that area and they need to be up and running. So we partner a lot with DFA, Cal OES, FEMA, and the state boards and stuff like that for to try and get these things together, come up with resources, and help everybody find the funding that they need. It's been kind of a struggle. As everyone knows, you know, there's a limited amount of that, and there's a lot of people that are looking for help right now, and it's going to only get bigger as this goes along. The third workshop was on emergency permitting. That's, you know, as the wildfires and stuff occur, there are different things that need to happen. We worked with the different BDOs, the different regions, pulled everybody together. And one of the things we did was to get a state 401 certification waiver so that there was a streamlined process for when Cal OES and Cal Recycle went out and did the work that they had to do for the phase two debris removal operations. So, you know, they could have the process in place, know who to contact immediately. So we could try and get that work done and get people back onto their land as quickly as possible and get their lives moving again. And the last one we did was the coordination and communication one. We work a lot, as you heard, from different organizations. We interface with a lot of them, and we found that bringing all those groups together to talk and break down those silos is what really seems to work best in getting people the help they need. So we run different work groups. An example would be that we have a BMP installation work group that helps with everybody from your private property owner to the counties on up to the regional boards, find the resources they need when sedimentation and erosion, BMPs need to be put in place to protect the watershed from the wildfire debris and things of that nature. So that's kind of a quick nutshell. I try to be get everything in as quickly as possible and be respectful of your time. But if there are any questions at this moment, please feel free to ask them and I'll do my best to answer what I can.
Thank you. Do we have any questions?
I have two related questions, I guess. is there an assessment of how ready Region 9 is for to respond to an emergency, and what steps are taken in place to like continue to audit our emergency preparedness so that it's not just a one snapshot in time scenario?
Yeah. Kimberly has been doing an excellent job at pulling together the emergency response plan. The state just redid, the water boards just redid their statewide emergency response plan. We now have a template for the regional boards to work on theirs. One of the things we're doing is helping them set up both a succession matrix so that when a wildfire or some other emergency happens, they already know the roles and responsibilities in the offices that they need to go to, who's the person to ask for certain things. And the other part is they also are setting up what's basically a technical advisor slash subject matter expert list. So that way, you know, if there's a problem with mining, if there's a problem with, you know, USTs, if there's a problem with site cleanup, whatever, you know, program it might be, there's already an individual identified so that we can, you know, cut down on the response time. And, you know, if the county or the state or the one of the operational areas say, hey, we need help with this area, we know who to go to right away and identify those people. Region 9 is probably the farthest along of most anybody. So they have done a really great job at getting those lists together. And there'll be additional training coming with that. Our plan is to get everybody we can with that same information in all the different regions. And then once we get those regional or those emergency response plans in place, we're going to start doing training exercises to test the plan, see where it needs to, where it breaks and where we need to fix it.
That sounds great. Did you have another question? Okay. Dr. Betty Olson has her hand.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to ask a quick question. So you talked about generators. These are pretty hilly areas. Do they have, do you have like a map with your GIS system of all the lift stations and all the pumps that go with both the, I guess the wastewater is more important at this point than the drinking water, but
yeah, no, we do not at the moment, Dr. Olson. That's one of the things I had mentioned, the water resource control engineer we just brought on, he's getting together a list for us of all the facilities. One of the things that we discovered last year when we were doing some of this work, you know, for the PSPS events and for the wildfires is drinking water, as you said, it has a very robust system set up to contact and to notify and to get in touch with all the different operators and plants and stuff. Wastewater, for some reason, has not been deemed sometimes as important, but it is just as important. It's something that everybody needs to pay attention to because it's the other side of the coin. And, you know, if you don't have a way to deal with the waste, then, you know, having the drinking water is not going to be as useful to you. So, and another piece of that, of course, is Cal Fire has expressed interest in the recycled water to battle fires with.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's a very important piece. So we're starting to pull that together. We're working with different regions. Everybody, you know, we have a list now of over 900 facilities. We've pulled together a good contact list on how to kind of reach out to those people. We're getting LIRIS mailing list set up so that we can do quick email blast out to, you know, disseminate information. And there has been talk about a map that shows all that. You know, the problem is some systems are very sophisticated and they have GIS people that can readily put that stuff together and draw boundaries and show where that those items are. You have a lot of other systems, though, that are very small that either don't can't afford or don't have the people to do that. So one of the conversations being had is how do we get that, you know, across the state on everybody on an equal footing to get that information together. But that's definitely something that is being discussed because, you know, as of course your question indicates, that's a very important piece of the puzzle is to know where all that stuff is.
Okay, great. Thank you. I just, for our area, that probably that information is readily available for a lot of systems. Okay.
Yes, so. Yes. That's the, then, yeah, like I said, that's the problem. Some places have great information and some places have next to none. So It's going to be a matter of cobbling those two together.
Thank you. Ms. McMurray Cathcart.
Yes, I just wanted to segue off of the question from Chairmember Olson about a GIS layer that would show the lift stations, et cetera. as I understand it, with the sanitary sewer overflow general order enrollments, so everyone with a collection system would be enrolled in that general order, they have access to the California Integrated Water Quality System database. And as one of the proposals in this new general order, they would be required to upload their GIS shapefile layers or KML files to the portal in which they upload their other data to report their overflows. Now, just for your information, I know there's been some pushback about whether or not they should be required, some of the comments that have been taken, because it would unduly affect the smaller community systems that Mark mentioned that may not be as capable of this. But some of those systems, of course, are in areas that are underserved, and perhaps we would be better prepared to serve them if we had the information. So that's all I know about the current status of that information in a GIS format.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Are we ready to move to consent calendar?
Thank you, Chair Cantu, members of the board. That concludes my report for this month.
Thank you very much. We'll take the consent calendar, and after that, we'll take a short break. So the items on the consent calendar may be removed at the request of any board member or any person. If an item is removed from the uncontested item calendar, it will be only voted on at this meeting if the board accepts the staff recommendation for the agenda item. Otherwise, the item will be continued to a subsequent board meeting to allow input by interested persons. I'll entertain a motion to accept the consent calendar, which is the rescission of order number 8648, waste discharge requirement for Kathleen Rosenau and Frank Spefasek. I may have that terribly wrong, and my apologies, for Pinecrest Park, San Diego County. I hear no request to remove it, in which case I'll entertain a motion to adopt the consent calendar.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All those, will the clerk please call the roll?
Dr. Barbanel?
Aye.
Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Aye.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mr. Strong?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
And Chair Cantu?
Aye. Thank you very much. At this point, let's take a break and reconvene at 10:35 on the dot. It is now 10:27, so that is our brief but a little bit extra generous break. So we'll reconvene at 10:35. Thank you very much.
Okay, Madam Chair, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. Our next item is an action item, and I think it's a particularly exciting action item. And this is consideration of adopting our operational plan. And I'll turn it over to our executive officer for presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, I believe you have my presentation to run.
Give me one second here. Too many moving parts.
Must be a slow connection speed today. Would you like me to just bring it up?
It looks like, okay, Roger's got it.
There we go. Thank you, Roger. Chair Cantu and members of the board, good morning. Today, I am presenting the annual accomplishments reports, which is attachment 2 of this item, and a summary of our fiscal year 2021-2022 operations plan. The resources that implementation of this operations plan will entail is presented for your consideration in the supporting documents of tentative resolution R9-20210162, which is attachment 1 of this package. I've asked several of our staff who put all this together to be available today if you have any questions on some of the details of the accomplishments or of the projects in the operations plan for this fiscal year. Next slide. Some of our accomplishments for this year, despite the challenges of the pandemic and the staffing reductions that came along with that, our efforts largely remained on track due to the dedicated hard work of your staff. Truly, they have been fully engaged during the last year and have surmounted the challenges, technical and otherwise, to help accomplish this. So I'm starting with the last item on that bullet list. A few of the accomplishments I'd like to highlight in the pandemic and response and ability of using modern monitoring tools that we've been exploring recently that truly paid off this last year and a half to be able to utilize the CCTV cameras, the GIS, the mapping, the satellite imagery where we've been able to get at, even if it's a few years old, it has helped make this job possible, even working remotely as we have been. Our staff were responsive to requests from regulated parties for appropriate relief during the lockdown in early 2020, but also held the line on protecting water quality and beneficial uses where appropriate, and were able to get out in the field at several times when it was safe to do so to continue inspections. We were also able to do remote inspections of wastewater treatment plants by checking in with the operators by phone, thus ensuring that we did not risk the operator's health or the administrative staff, who are often the operator's backups. And as we heard earlier from Mark Baer, wastewater really matters. We want to make sure that that continues to operate. So even when we had to curtail inspections during critical periods, we were able to maintain our oversight and our engagement. Our efforts to address the many impacts of the transboundary flows continued through 2020, as we discussed earlier, culminating in your adoption of the IBWC's NPDES permit and cease and desist order, and the engagement with US EPA on the USMCA process, as I mentioned, and making significant progress on the 2 total maximum daily loads I'll talk about in a few moments. Those efforts continue as I describe in our operations plan in this fiscal year. I would also like to report that acting on the authority that you've delegated to me, I authorized a general water quality certification for the City of San Diego Waterways Maintenance Plan that addresses the long-standing need for infrastructure maintenance and improvements while also including appropriate mitigation for unavoidable impacts. At times, small or undersized or damaged culverts have failed, and the City of San Diego has had to pay out millions of dollars in damages to property owners. We've had channels that have lost flood control capacity due to overgrowth of vegetation, and these are concrete channels where vegetation really wasn't intended. But nonetheless, these types of habitats and areas have important value, and so having a long-term plan with appropriate mitigation for unavoidable impacts has been a long-standing need that we were glad to finally be able to begin to address, largely through the efforts of Dr. Jill Harris of your staff, as well as the City of San Diego's Stormwater Department. In addition, as you saw at the June meeting, our staff were able to partner with the San Diego State University SAGE program, even while we're remote working, to map and evaluate the risk associated with historic dry cleaner operations and identify 37 of those facilities in underserved communities that we will focus on in our site cleanup unit efforts to address in future months and years. And in November, I think a very important milestone, you adopted the first biological objectives in the state of California for wadeable rivers and streams that use the California Stream Condition Index. While there are other biological objectives in place in other regions like the Santa Ana region, they don't use this tool with the latest science and science that's intended to adapt with changing hydrology conditions from climate change and increased drought and aridity as we're experiencing right now. This is a key step in addressing the need for quantifiable and accurate measurements in the attainment of our aquatic life use, beneficial uses, warm and cold, for example, in our rivers and streams, and being able to implement an historic outcomes-based approach of strategizing for healthy waters chapter of our practical vision. In December, you also adopted the Basin Plan Amendment to add three beneficial uses, tribal culture, tribal subsistence, T-sub, and subsistence beneficial uses, which I will mention again in a few moments. Next slide. As I shared with you last year, we're now utilizing an approach you authorized in Resolution R9-2017-0030 to group beneficial uses and identify key beneficial uses. And to achieve those key beneficial uses, we've identified specific outcomes and strategies to achieve those outcomes. The key beneficial uses, as you can see on the screen, are healthy aquatic ecosystems. The biological objectives I spoke of a moment ago is one of several projects in that category. Unimpaired fish and shellfish consumption, being able to eat the fish and shellfish we catch without undue risk due to carcinogens or other chemicals. Unrestricted recreation. There's really two aspects to this. One is the bacterial indicators and is it safe to swim? But also included in this is, are we able to access recreational areas? As climate change progresses and sea level rises and erosion increases, we may find that the public is unable to access historically available sites to enjoy the coast, for example. And of course, sustainable local water supplies. This has been a keystone of our practical vision going back to 2012. Where we begin looking at levers that we can pull, efforts we can make with local water purveyors to ensure sustainable local water supplies. Next slide. So this is the structure of the Healthy Waters approach. I shared this with you last year. I'm not going to go through all of these slides and read them all, but you will also see this represented in the structure of the table in attachment one of the agenda item. This is the structure for the healthy aquatic ecosystems beneficial uses. We've identified two key outcomes and several strategies. There can be multiple projects, some of short duration, some of several years duration, to implement these strategies and achieve the outcomes. I'm going to touch on just a few of those today. Next slide. This is unimpaired consumption of fish and shellfish. Next slide. Unrestricted recreation. And you can see the bifurcation in our efforts, the two different focal areas. Next slide. And the sustainable local water supplies. Lots of outcomes and lots of projects there. Next slide. This year's operations plan includes 41 projects and commits 22% of our available resources to these priorities. There is a great deal of work that takes place at the Water Board below decks, as it were. There are ministerial actions to authorize groundwater discharges, for example. There are permit reissuances, fireworks, for example, that we do. A lot of the work that we do on a day-to-day basis continues, and it's not reflected in these 41 projects. These 41 projects are the really important ones, the ones that take up the largest amount of staff time, and the ones that act as force multipliers that enable our programs to be more effective. They are all within our funding authority and their discretion, and this discretion is being asked of you today to exercise. This, of course, represents only a portion of our mission, which is rather incompletely supported with only 66 personnel years of staffing and an annual budget of $16,312,060. Incompletely supported, I base on a 2000 and 2001 cost factors analysis, which showed that the San Diego Water Board, to meet statutory obligations, needed at that time not less than 125 personnel years. We have 66. We've never had more than 79. And prioritization becomes a critical activity. What has often been lacking, however, and which we're trying to address in today's action, for example, is to try to put some transparency on how we select those priorities. We're using the key beneficial uses approach and the outcomes and strategies, and to give you and the public a chance to see these and act upon them at your discretion. This is different than the bureaucratic approach we used to take, where we focused on spending the dollars we had rather than actually attaining the outcomes, and the public was often mystified by the selection of the projects or activities. It's an imperfect solution, but we're still working this issue. So now I'm going to proceed through the several key beneficial uses and discuss some of the key projects that we're asking you to endorse today by Resolution R9-2021-0162. Next slide, please. This is the first of two slides on healthy waters. To achieve healthy aquatic ecosystems, we're focusing on several projects initiated in previous years, including the biological objectives projects I just mentioned for wadeable rivers and streams. We have to see this through the approval process at the State Board, the Office of Administrative Law, and US EPA before they become effective. But we're also calibrating the biological objectives to non-perennial streams that go dry. And as we proceed through these drought cycles, we have streams that shift back and forth from perennial to non-perennial. We want to make sure that this California Stream Condition Index can be appropriately applied to non-perennial streams that may only have short durations of flow. So that will be some of the work that we're continuing and proposing to continue in this year's triennial review. We are also working on several projects that are complementary and self-reinforcing on the Tijuana River Border Pollution Control projects or actions. You're going to hear about some of these several times because they appear in several different places of our approach. So you may hear about the Tijuana River TMDLs more than once. In this fiscal year, we are proposing in the triennial review that you will consider later to update our basin plan to begin the work of designating waters in the basin plan for each of the tribal subsistence beneficial uses that I mentioned a few moments ago, culture, T-sub, and sub, in the basin plan that you added last year. This will be a significant project. It will take a great deal of time, and it is one of the projects that's pending in the triennial review, and we anticipate being able to bring that resolution to you for your consideration perhaps in November or December, following up on the workshops we held this month. We're also proposing to bring to the San Diego region outcomes-based watershed approach stormwater permit to you for your consideration, most likely in fiscal year 2021 or 2022, but most of the work in the public engagement, the technical and the legal work in that very large and complex permit will take place this year. So stay tuned for that. We anticipate bringing that regional stormwater permit to you probably in the latter half of next calendar year. That will be one of the most important actions that we take next year, frankly. We are also beginning work on a new total maximum daily load or total maximum daily load alternative for the Santa Margarita River pictured there in the upper left. This will complement the effort that you approved for the Santa Margarita River estuary in May of 2019. Next slide. Continuing in the healthy aquatic ecosystems, because there's a lot of work there, we're also continuing to implement several projects to improve wetlands restoration, as well as permitting actions effectiveness to maintain or attain a meaningful net gain of wetlands. All of this while we work severely understaffed in this program and are now challenged by drastic changes in federal regulations governing permitting wetlands authority and timing of those actions. We are still working through what those mean to us in terms of implementing the State Board's adopted wetlands policy, and we'll have an opportunity to update you again in December on this in more detail as we do each year. And there'll be a chance, I think, for you to see how the federal regulation changes have really been playing out in real time this year. And it isn't necessarily with the goal of attaining a meaningful net gain of wetlands. It is about processing projects faster rather than getting better outcomes in our candid view. Nonetheless, we are maintaining our efforts in this regard, and we have several projects to try to improve the effectiveness of this program, as well as the timeliness where relatively small impacts can be regulated more timely. We're proposing to spend significant more staff time in water quality-driven compliance investigations. This is an outcomes-based compliance effort that's focused on areas with poor water quality indicators rather than simple paperwork or typical permit violations. And it will use the spatial mapping and visualization tools we've shared with you in previous meetings. as well as the information management tools that we can look at and see what are the conditions of the water, where do we need to be present, where do we need to do inspections, and what types of coordination can we do among multiple permits or waste discharge requirements or tools that we have. That has not been the way that we've pursued enforcement often in the past. That tends to be incident or event focused or paperwork focused. So we're going to spend more time out in the field looking at these types of issues from the other side of the coin. And that slide in the, on the bottom there, those are bacterial samples collected from San Diego streams, and those are not showing us what we would want to see. That's an MPN test that's showing results consistent with sewage and in one of our drainages. And that was taken quite a few years ago, but it's a relevant slide for this issue. Finally, we are also stepping up our inspections of agricultural operations and nurseries in key beneficial use areas. Although this project only identifies 40 hours this year, we are focusing on the most important operations or nurseries in the key areas, not trying to canvas all of them in one go. And this will inform future years' inspection priorities. Next slide, please. Unimpaired consumption of fish and shellfish. This is actually one of our environmental justice priorities. As we've reported to you before, this work focused primarily in San Diego Bay is where members of some underserved communities actively engage in subsistence fishing and are exposed to contaminants and pollutants in the fish tissue and shellfish tissue from legacy activities in and around San Diego Bay. We are continuing to clean up legacy pollutants and contaminants at some sites, and to achieve the outcomes mandated by State Board and its adoption of sediment water quality objectives. These projects include the ones that are listed here. They're not limited to them, however. There are cases that we're working in the enforcement program or ministerially that don't show up on this list, but nonetheless take a great deal of our staff's time, as well as the time of State Board and Council advising us on. One that I really want to emphasize is the Unified San Diego Bay Monitoring Program. Several agencies collected data and information around San Diego Bay. We are proposing to bring a unified monitoring program together and to bring it to you for your consideration, probably by tentative resolution later in this year. Wayne Chu of our staff is leading that effort. He is currently unavailable, but we have several staff available if you would like to know more about that. We're also implementing the SEP that you authorized last year for two projects. One of them is relevant to fish tissue. We're working with SCWRP, the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, to begin designing an MOA to work together and a scope of work for fish tissue monitoring to complement the work that's gone into this so far. And I'm happy to report that among our accomplishments and something that we're continuing to address is the San Diego Bay Sediment Cleanup Assessment. For the adoption of the cleanup and abatement order for NASCO and BAE shipyards that you made in 2013, I can report that the monitoring for the post-remedial conditions show that we are in fact achieving what we intended with that cleanup and abatement order. A healthy water chemistry, a healthy benthic chemistry, and a healthy benthic community seem to be coming together in the post-remedial footprint of that. But the proof is in the data, and we're continuing to collect data and evaluate that condition at that location and others around San Diego Bay to ensure the efficacy of the cleanup orders adopted by the board and then implemented at no small cost by the dischargers alleged to have been in violation. We have the opportunity now to present our updated state of the Bay later this year, rather than in August, when Mr. Chu is back in with us. And we'll provide you more information on that unified monitoring program and some of the specifics around the SQOs, the cleanup assessment, and the fish tissue work. He, of course, was one of the people who put together the sediment data divot database that's actually able to show us a map of the sites that are impaired. And I recently used that map with a presentation to my colleagues at State Board to show the relationship between historic red zoning and industrial activity, environmental justice or underserved communities, and where our cleanup efforts need to be focused in San Diego Bay using his map. Next slide. For unrestricted recreation, well, no topic about unrestricted recreation would go unserved if we didn't talk about the Tijuana River, of course. There we have significant impacts, not only to the ability to recreate in the river valley and on the beaches, but to the city of Imperial Beach and the city of San Diego and the underserved community of San Ysidro. These impacts, of course, as we've talked about several times, even today, have been longstanding and have been deep. This is a picture in the upper left of Smuggler's Gulch looking upstream. Tijuana River looking upstream at the confluence of Smuggler's Gulch. But we also have issues elsewhere in our region almost as large in different respects. Homeless issues, for example, and encampments. That's a picture of the Grantville site that the San Diego River Park Foundation alerted us to and that we've worked with them on. We've also been now prioritizing human source REC 1 violations, looking at sources of human fecal waste that might need immediate attention rather than waiting until we've done an exhaustive several year study like we are doing in the San Diego River. We're in the third year of that process now, and among our partners on that is the River Park Foundation that you'll hear from in a few moments. Along with the municipalities and the districts and agencies, we've been collecting and evaluating data on the several various potential sources and conveyances of human fecal waste, and that information, when it comes together, will inform us on the effectiveness of the management measures, whether they are in the stormwater program or they are in the leak prevention programs, for example, of our municipal wastewater treatment systems. We are also dedicating 500 staff hours to that new effort to prioritize violations for REC 1. So this is a new approach for us. And Dr. Yu is with us today, able to answer any questions you have on that. This is one of the other projects that we're also working with SCORP on, the regional pathogen monitoring. With your adoption of the SEP that I mentioned a few moments ago, we're putting together the memorandum of agreement with SCORP, and we'll begin investing SEP monies that are approved for that project on the regional pathogen monitoring to augment the work that we've done to date. And finally, we are proposing in this year's triennial review for your consideration to initiate the development of a new REC 1 water quality objectives and numeric thresholds for human marker HF-183 or other indicators, and to update the total maximum daily loads that were previously adopted for bacterial indicators to ensure that we are protective of the recreational beneficial use, but also that we're applying our effectiveness measurements in the right way, that we are actually reducing the sources that matter where they matter, rather than across the board BMPs for all sources of bacteria, which include some that are not related to human pathogens. This has been a long requested and an important refinement in our basin plan. It will be a project of some years, but it builds upon the investment of several efforts like the Surfer Health Study, the cost-benefit analysis of the TMDLs, and the work of the municipalities in the San Diego region over the last several years in the regional stormwater permit, which in the watershed water quality improvement plans, they frequently identified the bacterial indicators exceedances as their priority target of a pollution to address in their programs. Next slide. Sustainable local water supplies. This is a fairly recent map, though not the most recent, of the state of California's current drought and the magnitude of it. And while at the moment we are in a pleasant shade of tan, that won't last forever. Indeed, I don't expect it to last much beyond this year. Even though we've invested in alternative local supplies of water, we're going to face the types of heart-wrenching decisions that are being made across the state and the costs to the community from drought. So where we can, we're continuing to implement this chapter of our practical vision in several key respects. I believe you will be happy to know that we plan to reinitiate our board outreach approach that we've started a few years ago. We'll be scheduling meetings with board members and agencies specifically on the subject of drought response and resilience, though other topics can also be considered. So we'll be scheduling some of those meetings, most likely remote meetings, Teams or Zoom to start with, and when it is possible, we'll begin meeting in person with those agencies and members of the public on this subject. We have in our municipal stormwater permit a prohibition on landscape runoff and over-irrigation runoff. Now, in this slide on the bottom, I'm happy to report that that's no longer the case. That grass has been removed and those sprinklers have been turned off. But that's a pretty fair example of some of the issues we have in the region where those events do take place. We have previously conducted audits on the municipalities for their enforcement of this prohibition. We have found reasons for concern. In this year, we are proposing that our enforcement team will begin to enforce these permit prohibitions on landscape runoff and over-irrigation runoff, following up on these audits to reinforce the message that beyond just attaining a 15% reduction, we have to stop wasting this water and contributing to the issue of exceedances of bacterial indicators by conveying wastes downstream in dry weathers like this. Finally, and more importantly, we are working now with several agencies on groundwater and surface water augmentation projects, including the City of Oceanside and Padre Dam and Helix water districts. And later this year, you'll have a chance to review and approve a desalination brine disposal requirements for the Doheny Desal project that was mentioned earlier, the South Coast Water District's project for a slant well intake desalination project in the MPDS permit reissuance for SOCWA's San Juan Ocean outfall. Because it's a subsurface intake, you're not facing the kinds of permitting dilemmas and questions that we had to address in the Poseidon permit in Carlsbad. And so this project is moving forward, and we anticipate that permit being before you by December of this year. Next slide. Sustainable water supply has continued. The upper picture is more of an accomplishment from last year in the efforts of the Santa Margarita Water District in particular to provide for surface water storage of recycled water for later reuse. That's the Trompas Reservoir. We are expanding our efforts for recycled water production and purveyance. But to be quite candid, we're finding that we're at the threshold of effectiveness for purple pipe expansions. The real future of recycled water reuse is in potable reuse, indirect, indirect potable reuse. So the picture on the bottom right is the Padre Dam test facility for the project I mentioned a few moments ago. We are also, however, reviewing salt and nutrient management plans and evaluating potential water quality objective impediments to the effective reuse of recycled wastewater. There are some places where our basin plan salt and nutrients could be reviewed in order to facilitate that use, or even for the use of captured stormwater. So these are longer term projects to look at our basin plan that are also proposed in this year's triennial review that you'll consider later in the year, but I'm including them among our work right now. Even if you were to change the resolution, there's a lot of lead work that go into these projects and a lot of work that can go into them on ministerial actions or permit approval actions that you can consider separately from the basin plan. Next slide. For all the other beneficial uses and the region in general, I'm happy to share with you that our staff have been actively engaged with the State Board on the Racial Equity Working Group, and internally we've had a Racial Equity and Environmental Justice Discussion Group to try to bring this issue to light and to focus our agency's attempts to address this both externally and also internally, how we're organized and how we work with one another. We're working on climate change adaptation implementation, real things to try to address the several types of changes. We helped inform the report that comprises those several photographs on the top in terms of how to adapt climate change, and we'll be considering that type of information in our permit actions wherever practicable. And developing coastal resiliency is as much about being able to ensure the public's future access to beaches that may be lost by sea level rise or erosion as it is about ensuring that we have a coast that isn't just a hardscape of seawalls to protect properties and inland areas. In our monitoring efforts, continue to address climate change and other receiving water conditions through projects implemented in the permits you've adopted, including plume tracking. This is actually a very important aspect of addressing things like ocean acidification, being able to be sure we actually know where wastewater plumes that are discharged offshore are really going. Not only helps inform the receiving waters monitoring, which is laid out in the grid, but it also helps inform us where we may have local effects from elevated nutrients as ocean acidification continues to progress with climate change. So that's another aspect of our region-wide work. And finally, of course, our staff are our most important asset and resource, and we've been working with them through our practical vision chapters and in response to a Cal EPA employee engagement survey last year to address morale issues and staff improvement issues to be a more effective organization and one that we are all proud to be a part of in service to the members of the public. So I have given you an enormous amount of information at a rapid pace. My staff and I are very happy to address your questions. Next slide. On any of the projects that we've had. And my recommendation today is that for all the foregoing reasons that you adopt the resolution and the funding allocations for our staff in R920210162. So thank you very much for your time and attention today. That concludes my presentation. We can go to the next slide for a pretty picture, if you wish, just to give us something to look at while we talk about our update.
Hooray for pretty pictures.
That was actually taken at La Jolla this summer, 4th of July weekend. So it's a fair example of a small beach that may be lost to climate change, but it's also just a nice reminder of why we do the work that we do. Thank you, Roger. We can go ahead and close now.
Thank you, Executive Officer Gibson. That was a lot, and it's a very, it lays out a very exciting work plan for upcoming times. We'll open up it up for questions, comments from the board. You did such a great job. There seems to be no, oh, here comes the hands.
There we
go. A flurry of hands in the nick of time. Dr. Betty Olson, I saw yours first.
I just wanted to say, I think this is an amazing work plan. And I, with the restrictions that you have, I had no idea about the staffing was so much below what is recommended. I knew we were below, but I didn't realize we were that much below. So this is a fantastic work plan. I think this is something that we all can endorse. And that's all. I just wanted to say great job to you and the staff. Thank you.
Thank you. The thanks really go to the staff. They not only put together this work plan, but they're the ones who do the hard work in all of this.
Henry, your hand had been up, but was your point made by Betty?
95% of it. I also want to say thank you so much to Dave and your staff. Given the, let's see, 5% of the staff is still taken by the state. Is that correct?
Fortunately, Henry, we have had them returned to us. Oh, also, Jody Ebsen, for example, just returned to us, as did Brian McDaniels. Jimmy Smith continues on assignment at his request, and it was probably a really good idea given the Delta variant issues we're seeing around the state. He's working on contact tracing for the state.
In that case, I can only offer my total support for your plan.
Thank you.
Any other comments, questions? Well, I think it is remarkable, and I'm very excited to be able to vote in favor of it. We need to keep in mind that our staff has just a tad more than 50% of what is the analysis to do the work that we're tasked to do. And that's just the regular routine, ongoing obligations, not special efforts that, you know, punctuate and populate our activities at all times. So, and that's nothing new, that's been for a very long time. And that also is not including the last year's reduction in force, because we were going broke in the beginning of the fiscal year. Now we're not, but at that point we were, and everybody took a reduction and got a reduction in their workload. And of course, contract tracing, as Henry already mentioned. So congratulations. I'm very excited about this upcoming year. If there are no further comments, I'll entertain a motion to approve this resolution.
I so move.
Thank you.
Gary, I'll second it.
Thank you. Any discussion? Will the clerk please call the roll?
Dr. Rabanel?
Aye.
Mr. Anderson?
An enthusiastic aye.
Ms. Thanks Blair?
Aye.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mrs. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
And Chair Cantu?
Aye. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have two very interesting informational items today. The first is an update from the San Diego River. The San Diego River Park Foundation will provide an update on the Healthy Waters initiatives at the headwaters and a trash-free campaign in the lower river.
Well, good morning, Chair Cantu. Thank you so much, and to all the board members. We really appreciate the opportunity to be with you today. Over the years, we've had a really excellent relationship, working relationship with the Water Board, and your staff are truly amazing, professional, talented, knowledgeable people, and we really value them. I can never do a presentation without just acknowledging how wonderful your staff is. I am Rob Hutzel, CEO of the San Diego River Park Foundation and one of its founders. With me today is Sarah Hutmacher, our Chief Associate Director. I think you'll find that she is much more gifted than I, and a wonderful core part of our team. If you're not familiar with our organization, we are a 501c3 public benefit nonprofit that was founded 20 years ago. In July was our 20th anniversary. It's hard to believe. It's been that long that I've been working with you all. And Dave has been there, I think, all 20 years. Our mission is quite simply to create a better future for our San Diego River and its ecoregion. And we do that by engaging people. We do a lot of different things throughout the 440 square mile San Diego River watershed. Hopefully we have a presentation that's ready. I know that Sarah was going to fire that up. Today we are planning to give an update on just two of the programs that we do, our Healthy Waters Initiative and the Trash-Free River Campaign. Sarah, can you fire up that presentation? Maybe? There we go. If we can go to the next slide, please. There we go. The Healthy Waters Initiative is our effort to conserve the amazing headwaters of the San Diego River. If you haven't been there, I really strongly encourage you to get out there. It's absolutely gorgeous, especially in the springtime where you'll see waterfalls like Mildred Falls here, which is Ritchie Creek. If you look to the left is the Upper San Diego River Gorge proper. Much of this land is public public lands, either the Cleveland National Forest, Rancho Cuyamaca State Park, even part of Anza Borrego State Park is in the headwaters of the river. There's county lands and other public lands, but surprising to many, there's also a lot of private land. Next slide, please. The initiative has three components, as you see there, our land acquisition program, our monitoring and research efforts, and our efforts once we acquire the land to restore them and to do barrier removal. Next slide, please. Our current work, as you can see here, kind of starts in the upper, what do you call that, the upper right side, which is where the San Diego River proper is, down through the streams and creeks that reach down to Boulder Creek. If you're familiar with Lake Cuyamaca, Lake Cuyamaca is formed on Boulder Creek. So in between there, we have creeks like Temescal Creek, Ritchie Creek, Cedar Creek, and Boulder Creek. Next slide, please. Our land acquisitions. Our land acquisitions, as you can see here, is Temescal Creek. This is Eagle Peak Ranch. Believe it or not, this, what you might call a cattle pond, was formed on the creek, and there's several different hydromodifications on the creek, but our initial effort was to acquire this. It was a 299-acre acquisition. Next slide, please. This is, I think, a board member, Strawn's, one of his favorite projects on Boulder Creek. This is Fisherman's Camp. And Boulder Creek is a beautiful, beautiful creek that has a lot of conservation values. Next slide, please. Our acquisition current focus right now is on Ritchie Creek. There's a wonderful section of Ritchie Creek, 180-acre property that we've been in discussion with the landowners, just as an example. It'll require about $1 million for us to raise. And then there, we have several other additional properties on Boulder Creek and Ritchie Creek that we've identified for acquisition. Next slide, please. Our monitoring and research programs, once we acquire those properties, and often we work on other properties in partnerships with either landowners, private and public, we go out and do water quality analysis to understand the health of the creek. That informs our actions in terms of future conservation measures, restoration efforts. We do a lot of different things. Some of you may be very familiar with our wildlife camera program known as Critter Cam. And then we also, you know, find things like southwestern pond turtles in places you don't expect. Next slide, please. Our restoration and barrier removal program. This is back on Boulder Creek. And so when we found this, you know, when we started it, we Gary actually had brought me down there because there had been wild trout identified on this property. It's known as Fisherman's Camp. we ended up acquiring the property, and then we set out to do what we do, which is how do you make it, how do you heal it? How do you make it better? What's the current condition and how do you protect the resource? So we were successful in getting state funds and we began a restoration project to heal this and to provide shade and put it in a stream buffer. And that work continues on even though the grant is over. Next slide, please.
Bob, can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
You just mentioned state funding once you've acquired the property. What is the foundation's major source of funding to make those big property acquisitions?
Private funding. Yeah, so one of the models, that, I appreciate that question. One of the models that we have is, you know, we do a lot of small acquisitions that don't fit well into, let's say, the big kids, some of our other partners. And if we find a piece of property, we contact them to say, is this something that will fit into your portfolio of conservation? Sometimes they'll say no. Sometimes they'll approach us and say, can you acquire this piece of property? And we have hundreds and hundreds of very generous people that support our land acquisition programs. Sometimes we will then take that money, then apply for a grant and leverage it that way too. But most of our acquisitions are small. I appreciate that question. Next slide, please. This project, hopefully some of you are familiar with. We were very, very fortunate that you directed some SEP funding to Temescal Creek to begin the healing process. So once we acquired this property, we started to see these hydromodifications. Working with your team, we identified some project and helped define the scope of it. This, what you see here, is now removed. And that land is healed. Next slide, please. We also received, as part of that SEP funding, funds to do a whole restoration plan for this 299, actually extended beyond that because we had acquired additional properties subsequent to that, to identify strategies to return what was from cattle grazing land. Land had been cattle grazed for 100 years and restore oak riparian woodland and riparian montane meadow habitat to this creek. This is a wonderful, wonderful creek, and there's terrific opportunity to make it wild once again. Next slide, please. Some of the challenges that we face in doing this process, I just wanted to share with you, was we worked, I think, for close to a year with the Army Corps of Engineers, even though it was a relatively minor project, all for environmental benefit. You know, staff changes and things like that, it really took us a long time to work through Army Corps of Engineers. And ultimately, they said, okay, you're fine. We wasted probably a year getting to that point. We also had to work through the County of San Diego to determine whether a grading permit was required. And I think their staff maybe worked a little creatively with us to find a way that nope, no permits required. But all of that took a lot of time, where it would have been, gosh, a lot simpler if those were defined exemptions that they could have just walked in initially and said, yep, you can go ahead and do that. That would lower the cost and obviously the time to heal this land. Next slide, please. I'm going to turn it over to Sarah. I was going to talk about the Trash Free River campaign. Sarah?
Thank you, everybody. And I appreciate the chance to talk a little bit about our trash program. I know that a lot of you have probably heard about a lot of the work that we do already on the creek, but there's, or along the main stem of the San Diego River, but there's been a lot of changes in the last few years and a lot of impact. So it's a great update. We appreciate the time. So we always like to just start with the scale of the trash problem. We estimate about 1 million pounds of trash enter the riverbed each year. And that estimate is based on the data that we collect, which we've been collecting now for over a decade. We do a point in time count in October where we assess the current condition of the riverbed. And we do a volumetric analysis by source of the different locations. And then this goes onto our data mapping tool. So we have the geospatial data that goes along with this. And what you can really see is that we were seeing a huge increase in that trash. We had a lot of attention brought to that issue in 2017, 2018. And then, of course, with COVID, we've seen a huge increase again. We'll be doing that count again in October, and we'll have some updated data then. But this is just sort of the big picture trends before we get into the detail. We survey about 1,200 acres of land, predominantly along the main stem of the San Diego River. The blue and green are the areas that we survey. That's in the city of San Diego and the city of Santee. We also survey the Forester Creek confluence at the vegetated section in the city of Santee, Chaparral Canyon, and Moses well as some other tributaries on an occasional basis. The reason why the River Park Foundation, I think, is essential to trash management is probably obvious to all of the people in this meeting, but there are 30 plus landowners, the City of San Diego, 6 different departments, City of Santee, you know, all these different public agencies, as well as different law enforcement entities, other nonprofits and volunteer groups, and of course the regulatory entities. And all of those groups mean that the land is managed in a slightly different way. Sometimes every 100 yards of the riverbed, there's a completely different strategy for land management. So the River Park Foundation serves to do the data collection so that there's a data-informed approach to all of this trash management, as well as help coordinate efforts so that partners can be working as collaboratively as possible. And I think we're also sort of the keepers of the big picture in some ways, so that we can kind of keep everybody informed about trends and emerging threats that we're seeing, opportunities for collaboration. That's what I'm going to get into later. But I do want to point out where the trash does occur. So this is the results for our most recent annual point in time survey. We've got about 11% of the trash on land owned by the City of San Diego. Almost 38% of the trash owned are on land owned by the City of Santee, about 20% on land owned by other public agencies, and about 30% on private property. So that's the most recent picture of that. But again, this is data that we collect on an ongoing basis so that we can kind of do these updates as frequently as needed. I mentioned that we really focus on this data-informed impact model. And really what that looks like is we go out and have teams on the ground with their, you know, feet in the riverbed, as not with drones or anything like that, just really getting under the vegetation to get the most accurate site and data condition as possible. They use that data to coordinate with landowners. And then there's a cleanup. Sometimes that's our teams that go out and clean up. Sometimes it's hired contractors or city staff or other entities. And then we go out again to always verify that that trash has been cleaned up effectively and help inform the ongoing process. All of this data is available on our public portal. The link is here, but for the just sake of time, I'm not gonna do the tour of that this time, but you guys are all, of course, welcome to view that portal. There is some data that is password protected related to active encampments. That's available if needed, but we could reach out to us if you need that information. So this is a more detailed snapshot of trash since 2017. You can see that there had been a pretty promising trend of trash kind of moving downward over those months. The orange data is encampment, active encampment. The kind of bright blue is the inactive encampments, so it accounts for, you know, more than half most of the time. You can see the other types of trash that we track. Unfortunately, with COVID, we had a big, huge change in the number of, in the amount of enforcement, in the amount of outreach available, in the amount of landowners that had resources to do their own resources. CDC had new guidelines about encampment-related cleanups. So we've thankfully started to level that number out, but we are still working to ramp everything back up so that we can start to see the impact that we had been seeing in 2019. I think one of the things that we wanted to highlight that's a new part of this program is that as a result of this data collection, we've found ourselves in this really exciting intersection with environment and homeless issues, where we feel like we can play a really important role in reducing and ending encampments in the riverbed. So we have a super extensive knowledge of the riverbed and all of those different parts that I already mentioned. We've got a lot of relationships with the stakeholders. We have this multi-year data set so that we can actually quantify what these impacts have been. And we have relationships with some of the individuals experiencing homelessness in the riverbed. Any given year, homelessness accounts for between 75 and 95% of the trash that we survey, that we map. So it's a huge contributor to the trash problem. And what we look for is opportunities to actually nip it in the bud. So we've been working since 2019, but really in earnest since 2020. to partner hands-on with an outreach partner. In this case, we've been working closely with PATH San Diego, although we work with other partners as well, to share data specifically related to encampments. And in that way, our staff, we're already in the riverbed. We already know what's going on. We already know some of the people. So we have a little bit of a trust already. We are able to help be a bridge to the services that help people and also help them seek resources to not be living in the riverbed anymore. So we're hoping that by doing this, we can have a much better way of not just moving the encampment related trash around in the riverbed, but actually ending the number of encampments that are happening in the riverbed. This partnership we have right now is still a pretty limited deployment of these outreach resources, but we are actively looking to expand. I also want to mention that even though, you know, in a typical year, our trash teams were able to pick up, you know, 300,000 pounds of trash, you know, closing in on that number in many years. Even in 2020, when we canceled basically all of our 100-person cleanups, our small core team of people are still incredibly nimble and incredibly active, able to respond to these issues and removed nearly 155,000 pounds of trash from the riverbed. And that was really with about 160 people total just coming out over and over and over again over the year. They did 90 cleanups, these crews, and over 4,000 hours of service, 150 assessments. They also completed some really targeted Arundel removal that we had been on, that was funded in part by the SEP from the city of San Diego, through the city of San Diego. And that was helping to reduce the areas that were serving as hotspots and catch points for a lot of the trash related to some of the encampment. I think the other thing is this gives us this other metric of impact that's sort of a little bit more of a reach for some of the truly environment related metrics that we usually focus on. But through our mapping support, our homeless outreach partners were able to make 294 contacts with people to provide masks and hand sanitizing resources, but also housing. So they had about 31 new clients that were not previously in the system that are now in the system. And 7 of those people have made it to a home. So we're, as I said before on that previous slide, you know, we're looking at about 70 encampments right now. I think it was 71 this morning. 32 of those are in the city of San Diego and the others are in the city of Santee. And when we feel like our multiplier on that, when we did our most recent census, we documented 201 people living in the riverbed, not, you know, a separate number from encampments. So 7 is a, you know, it's a step in the right direction. We've got a lot of work to do, obviously, but this is a problem that we feel uniquely able to influence in the sense that we can bring these resources in a way that is incredibly efficient because our teams just know exactly where everybody is. And despite all the moving parts, they're able to kind of keep an eye on everything and really bring that resource to have an impact on trash reduction specifically. And then of course, popular, from a public outreach standpoint, because they have increased intention, they provide an opportunity to engage with elected officials and media. So these are the types of encampments. I know you already saw a couple of slides that show these kinds of things in the day, but the water is just behind in the white, in the light area here. So these are all encampments where people are in definitely in harm's way. The floodwaters rise very quickly. I've personally been out when we've been trying to help people pack their things so that they aren't impacted by floods. And it's a huge step in the right direction, I think, both for the health of the river and the health of the water and the health of this habitat, as well as the well-being of the people that are living there in harm's way. I know I don't want to go too long on this part of this, but the teams that we deploy are this assessment team. There's a description here of what that team looks like. This is a very small, very trained team, often led by staff that has quite a lot of QAQC following up our data collection. The River Rescue Team is our team. This is the team that's been active during COVID. They go out once or twice a week in small teams, but they can pretty much tackle almost any type of trash that we have in the riverbed. And because of their experience, they're more able to work in areas that have been impacted by homeless encampments, where they know how to handle interaction with something that might be unsafe for a general member of the public. And then our clean and green team is our big community cleanups. And these teams have been on pause for a lot of the pandemic, but have restarted in smaller groups. And it's a really awesome opportunity for members of the public to wrap their arms around the types of issues that the river is facing and how we can really have a significant impact to address it. Rob, I think I'm throwing it back to you for this section, right?
Wow, cool. All right. I appreciate that, Sarah. The issues and challenges. There are two areas that we wanted to really bring to your attention. One of those is a classification that you would see if you pulled up our online mapping, which is what we call the special removal needed. Now, we like to follow the rules. When we first started, and we were all volunteer, maybe we bent the rules a little bit. It's been 20 years, so I guess I can say that. But these days, we have to follow the rules. And so there is often concern about what permits might be required if we need to dig something out. And so as an example, we'll find tires and boats and trash cans and parts of cars and different pieces out there, and we'll go, it's partially buried. Gosh, we need to check with somebody to find out if we're allowed to remove this. And that's something that clarification or working together, I think, with the Water Board staff, maybe we can find clarity about how to go ahead and proceed on removing some things that we probably could remove. So that's one issue. Tire disposal and different things like that become an issue. I remember the one time we removed a whole bunch of tires. We parked them on a public piece of land that we managed called the River Garden Mission Valley. And all of a sudden we got cited by the state because we were now all of a sudden a tire collection site or something, and we had to work through that issue. So I mean, there's various things that pop up like that about removing these harder to reach areas. The other issue is the troubled areas that we have a persistent problem with, and we really could use your assistance on. And that's an area, I think, Sarah, if we go forward one more, I think there's a slide or two here. Maybe I'm wrong. There's the underwatered and buried items. So, for instance, if we go back one, Sarah, I'm sorry, I forgot about that slide. If we'll find something like that person's pointing to, I think that's Morgan, is pointing to something underwater. It's like, uh-oh, we're going to need a permit. And that's the concern that pops into our mind. Do we need a permit? We have to go talk to somebody and work through it. Clarity on these issues. The other finger is pointing to something that's partially buried. We could easily remove it. But it's still sitting out there today because we're not sure what we can do. Next slide, please. This last slide, I believe it's the last slide, is the problem area that we're really faced with. It's been persistent. We really have seen a little bit of progress, but not enough. And so on the left, you'll see kind of a pretty good area. That's property we own. It's the future center of our location of our River Education Center at Grant Park. And then you'll see the next building there, the white-topped building with kind of the coral or salmon-colored sides. That's the U.S. Postal Service. They did after many years of work, they did a partial cleanup, but they never finished. We've recently kind of tried to reinstigate movement. Of course, COVID and a whole bunch of other challenges has created some issues. But what you find with a lot of these owners is they have a fence line. And behind the fence line, they have no means to go out and actually do something about it. At least they don't think they do. And so any support there with the U.S. Postal Service, the property next door is a privately owned property. Again, you can see the numbers there on the Postal Service. There's about 12,000 pounds of trash just sitting, accumulating and growing. And next door on that private property, there's about 2 tons of trash just sitting there. They've done a little bit of cleanup. I believe the city of San Diego has done some sort of enforcement action. But I got to tell you, it's not enough. And we need to do more. And why? Because if you don't look at these areas kind of holistically, people move from one place to another and back and forth and back and forth. You've got to have a holistic approach, program. We have that most every other section of the river in the city of San Diego. But for whatever reason, this one is probably the hardest to reach, the hardest to deal with maybe in some ways. When the water rises and it's wet, it's hard to get to. Making pathways in there is permit kind of issues. But we need to figure out a strategy to manage this part. On the right, going further, you'll see that there's 805 right outside your door almost. And underneath that is Caltrans. Now, Caltrans has been doing was doing a great job. They backed off a little in COVID. I know that they're working through some of their protocols as it relates to encampments. And we just got recently word that they're kind of working through that. So we expect that to be cleaned up again. So if we could just focus on this one area, I think it would really make a transformative difference for the overall number to drop significantly down. And we would love your assistance on that. Sarah, I believe that's the last slide. Maybe there's one more. Oh, thank you. So we just want to thank everybody. Of course, if there's time, we're happy to take any comments or questions. There's our contact information. We welcome comment. We'd happy to provide tours, show you what we're talking about, whatever we can do to continue our wonderful collaborative relationship. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Rob Hutzel or Sarah Huckmacher? Betty Olson, Dr. Olson. I saw Dr. Olson's hand up. Was that for a current question or was that from the past? Well, I'll invite Gary Strong, who's been a strong advocate for this work and keeps us up to date on a regular basis. So please, Board Member Strong.
Yeah, just a comment. You know, I want Rob and Sarah to jump in on this because I don't want to. It breaks my heart to see that you know, so much of those homeless camps have moved out to Santee. And I don't exactly know the reason. I felt like a couple of years ago, I've had to cut back on hauling trash out of the river. I'm just, I guess, too old for it. But I did a lot of that. I kind of got it all started many years ago with Rob and I. But we thought we were making progress, and it's just kind of gone the other way. And I don't believe that's because of anything the city of Santee is particularly doing, although I've had some discussions with the sheriff that doesn't think that homeless camps are his issue. I think primarily it's because the city has, in its wisdom, has built its parks all along the river. So a huge portion of the river where in San Diego, you may have, with the exception of where Rob was talking about, the buildings right up next to the trails, Santee can have, you know, hundreds of acres along there that are basically unimproved parkland, which is, you know, the right thing to do along the river, but it makes it really hard for them to control the camps. And so I don't know what the answer is to that. I know that they're trying to go out and with the Alpha Project and all the others trying to find homes for these people. And so few of them will accept that help for whatever reasons. It's just really a bad thing. Cause when you start, you know, I do still do all the water quality testing out there. And although we're not testing for bacteria, we look at a lot of other things and we get a lot of use. That trash is the main purveyor, I think, of the pathogens and the, you know, you take something, you know, high bacteria count, human feces or whatever, you put it out in the sun and the water and couple of days it's cooked, but if it's in a big pile of trash, it's there for a long time and the next storm takes it. So it's a huge problem. I think part of the problem in Santee is just that San Diego finally got really involved with the hepatitis thing and closed the camps, and so they just moved east. But you know, it's an issue. I really appreciate all the work that Rob and Sarah and their staff, and it's a wonderful staff. I mean, you see these kids out there every week, just and like you said, they know almost every homeless camp. You know, they know the people by name, they help haul the trash out, and they're just calling, you know, hauling tens of thousands of pounds per person out of that river every week. So congrats to them for all the work they're doing, and I just share the pain of seeing how that's its trend is reversed in the last couple of years.
Gary, I appreciate that. If I may just say a word or two, I disagree. I believe that in kind of I think there is a strategy. You know, the city of San Diego had a strategy which was working. And I think that was in part possibly because of some of the interest of the water board and working with the mayor's office at that time. We need the same level of effort in Santee. And the challenge is with COVID is CDC kind of issued some guidance that homeless encampments should be left alone. That it was best for people to stay in the encampments rather than be put into a shelter of some sort. And with that, the city of Santee took that and left it alone, literally. And that's why we saw it grow from maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 encampments to, what is it, Sarah, 39 today, something like that? 38?
39. Yeah.
And this is a relatively, as you know, Gary, a small section of the river. It needs management. And with that, we can address it. I just strongly believe that.
And I don't disagree with that, Rob. My point was, from what I've, the discussions I've had, is that the city council and the mayor are in favor of doing something. They just got total pushback from the sheriff's office saying that's not our issue. I know that. I mean, I've been out there doing the homeless camps every year for many years, and we've always had sheriffs with us. They used to know where the camps were. They used to be very involved, and they just aren't anymore. So
yeah, I agree. And I think part of that solution is to what Sarah was talking about, is to find a nonprofit partner like Path San Diego. There's others to rebuild, kind of, let's work on it person by person. And let's start to say that, you know, and this is just a value judgment I got to after, you know, 15 years of thinking, that it's not an appropriate place for people to live in a floodplain. It's just not. Their homes will be washed away. It's just not a healthy and safe condition. And so we need to find alternatives. But in the meantime, we need to take action to help people change their lives. And that takes a proactive approach.
Can I get proactive with the city council and try and push them to do something?
Please. And the city of San Diego, you know, city of Santee, I apologize, is they're a wonderful partner with us. We value them a lot, but I know that this issue with how to address the growth of encampments has overwhelmed them. And I agree with you, the contract they have with the county sheriffs has seen some dynamics there, let's say, and that's something that needs to be stabilized.
And I think the other part of it is that in the Boise decision makes it that it is not, you can't force people to leave an encampment unless they have someplace to go. And in the city of San Diego, they have invested a lot of in shelters so that there is an alternative. And that same alternative doesn't exist to the same extent in East County. So there's a lot of collaboration that needs to happen in order to get to a place where that enforcement can be effective. If that tool is a part of the toolbox that you need in order to kind of move the needle on the number of encampments. I completely agree with Rob. It seems to be a lot more effective to case manage people as opposed to just to enforce encampments when you're trying to move people into a longer term solution. But at the same time, that needs to be coordinated with enforcement and all the other moving parts.
Yeah, I don't want to throw anybody out. My experience was just that, having the sheriff and the city concerned and down there and reviewing and putting a little pressure on people, at least to clean things up, makes them a little more interested in talking to somebody about an alternative. That's when we were making headway a few years ago, that seemed to be you needed a stick, but you also needed to have a reward sitting out there too. So, okay, I'll shut up and let it go. Yeah. But thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you. Lori, is your response to this point? I see your hand is up, Lori Walsh.
Yeah, you know what, Chairman Cantu, I'll wait till Betty asks her question. I just wanted to update the board on our interaction with Rob and his staff.
Thank you very much. Dr. Betty Olson.
I just have a very quick question that I was kind of astounded. I heard the statistics for the Santa Monica Boardwalk, which has had a problem with homeless people this year. They have 2,000 homeless there, and all but 77 were not California residents. They'd come here from another state. Are you aware, are the people, since you have good knowledge, are the people Californians or are they from other states? Or I know it doesn't help with fixing the problem, but.
It does. I mean, we obviously run into people from different locations. I recall, you know, way back when I used to work in the mayor's office in the city of San Diego, before the river days, there was studies done in those days, and the people in the shelters, at least in San Diego, by and large, were from the city, or from the San Diego area. So the thought that people are coming out here and living here during the, you know, their winter or something, like it happens maybe a little bit, but that's not by and large who we're dealing with. Most of the people we're dealing with on the San Diego River, and Sarah, correct me if you feel differently, are chronic homeless, meaning that they've been homeless for a number of years here in San Diego.
Well, I just know this study was done this summer. So that I don't know if they've been there for a long time or they just are transitory. The other thing I wanted to say, I really wanted to compliment you on your work. And I also wanted to comment to say how well you've done. Of these 2,000, they only got 7 individuals placed. So your 30 number is a good number.
I appreciate that. I mean, in the city of San Diego, we went from 118 roughly encampments, so you can do the math, down to 9 pre-COVID. We were at 9. Now, where are all those people now? Some of the people went up into the canyons, for sure. We don't know the answer to that. That's something that we'd love to study if we can find some resources to do that. But many people got help. Some people belong in jail, and some people belong elsewhere, and some people move along. I mean, there's a whole different things, but the number came down to 9 encampments. That's roughly 18, 15 people in the city of San Diego. So when we saw literally in a few weeks that number jumped 600%, I think that there was. You knew that there was a lot of people out there that, for whatever reason, kind of came into the riverbed, and it needs to be actively managed. Otherwise, it's going to grow back up. And so I thank you so much for your comment. But one thing I've learned in doing this for 20 years is it's not a single event. It's a commitment to people and to value people that are living in the riverbed, but also understand you're in it for the long haul.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Board Member Strong.
Yeah, real quick. The annual homeless count, I think it's called We All Count, that they do, of course, all over the country. We do it in, I think, January, February, early in the morning. I believe, and those results are public. They didn't do much this year, except thanks to Sarah, we did it along the river just with our own volunteers. But most of that data, I believe, if you look at it, shows that it's a long-term. Most of the people are chronic. They're, you know, when you talk to them, I think 2 years ago, we had some little gifts we could give out if they would sit down for a couple minutes and answer questions. And, you know, so many of them, you know, I remember one young man, you know, asked him how long he'd been there. He said, my whole life. You know, it just, I don't think a movement in is what we're seeing. I think these are, you know, homegrown.
These are community members.
I think I think both of those last two questions sort of illustrate that, you know, our expertise is the riverbed. And what we know for a fact is that these encampments are contributing pollution to the riverbed. And we can track where that's happening, where the trends are, the hot spots, like what we can link sometimes the ebb and flow to that. And I think the homeless outreach partners, their expertise is the case management of why and what are the barriers to no longer being in that circumstance. And I think that's a perfect example of both of us doing what we do best, and with the outcome being fewer encampments in the riverbed, which benefits us because we're not dealing with the trash that's left behind, and benefits our partners because they're not seeing people suffering in a, you know, in that kind of environment anymore. So I think, you know, the main thing, we don't always know where people are from, or we know what they tell us, but we don't keep that kind of data. But our homeless outreach partners have the training to actually collect a lot more data about people's individual circumstance than we do. And they're able to then use that to help them get out of that barrier, and sometimes give us some de-identified data that helps inform the work.
We may have lost Sarah there. Yeah.
Maybe so. Executive Officer Gibson, and then Lori Walsh.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Cantu, and thank you, Rob and Sarah, very much for your presentation today and sharing a lot of good information and some uncomfortable information. I think we've all been aware of how things have changed in the last 18 months with the pandemic, and certainly I've also been aware as a resident in Santee that there simply are more homeless persons there now than there were previously. That's a large issue and somewhat outside of the ability of the board to address, but you came to us with two specific requests, which I think we can work on. First of all, Eric Becker of our staff and Roger Mitchell of our land discharge programs can work with you on the permissible cleanup activities. You know, how much is enough? How much is too much in terms of removing embedded tires, submerged trash, and so on? I think that there's actually far more allowance than not on that. And with regard to other state agencies, I would suggest that Roger especially can help liaison with those other agencies on the temporary storage of waste that's removed, like tires. That is a concern, and we've seen this in the Tijuana River Valley, of course, because there we have the Aedes aegypti, a container breeding mosquito that loves tires. So obviously there is a concern in terms of allowing tires to stand around for very long, even in the summer, if we might get some monsoonal rains, maybe not. When those tires get inundated, that's when the mosquito eggs hatch, and that's when it becomes a problem locally. But I think in both regards, we can work with you and other state agencies to make sure that you're not impeded from removing those tires, where they are no less of a problem when they're left in the river or in the riverbed. And then with regards to the properties, we've already met internally to discuss a couple of those, and so thank you for your information. I think we should definitely continue to interact and liaison with the other agencies and the property owners, and so our board and staff are prepared to work with you on those specific sites, understanding that they are but a fragment of the issues facing us with the discouraging numbers of new encampments that you mentioned. I would suggest that in the end, maybe there's a way for the Water Board to elevate this conversation through the local agencies, because you mentioned, I think, a dilemma that we face, which is San Diego does something, now Santee has to do something, will La Mesa have to do something, and so on. It really seems to call for a regional effort by local governments working together rather than a haphazard catch-as-catch-can, moment-to-moment approach. I don't know that I have a solution for that, but next month we will have the San Diego River Conservancy presenting to us, and perhaps just within the confines of the San Diego River, there's an opportunity for us to elevate the discussion of how can those several agencies, which include the city and county of San Diego, work together in support of the River Conservancy and the River Park Foundation to address these issues. And in the meantime, we will be focusing on those properties, and you may hear from certain of our staff on how we might be able to move forward on those. Thank you, Chair Cantu.
Thank you. Lori Walsh, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, just briefly, I have reached out to Rob. We've had a discussion about the Postal Service property. I've also reached out to the City of San Diego, and we are planning to get together and discuss that particular location, and we'll be involved to the most as we can to try and get that trash removed and picked up, and partner with the Postal Service, bring in those resources that the City of San Diego might have, the social resources, and maybe even law enforcement. The city hasn't gotten back to me yet, but I do expect to hear from them. So we are working with Rob and his team. And if it's something that a location in the City of Santee we can partner with, we'd be interested in doing that as well.
Thank you. That's great. And congratulations on your 20th anniversary, and thank you for that very informative presentation.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Now, with my apologies and your indulgence, we need to backtrack. It's been brought to my attention that I neglected to request any comments from the public regarding the practical vision. I mean, the operational plan. So we need to open that item back up and invite any comments or questions from the public regarding consideration of resolution Region 9, 2021-0162, supporting the operational plan. I don't think, Mr. Mitchell, I don't believe you have any cards, but will you take it from here?
No cards. Just as a quick reminder, if any member of the public would like to speak on this item, please go ahead and virtually raise your hand in Zoom or press star 9 on your phone now. Please remember to state your name for the record before you speak. Board Chair Cantu, surveying the attendees here, I do not see any hands being raised.
we'll just give them a moment in case they have a hard time finding that raise hand button like I do when different versions of Zoom. Yeah, we do apologize in our enthusiasm. We moved right past that very important point and the reason we're here, frankly. And so if there are any members of the public who would like to speak up now, we're available to you. If you are not able to communicate with us today, we're finalizing the operations plan and we can answer your questions or make some adjustments in that work post-adoption in the document itself, provided they're not major changes. If there are major changes of the sort that we would need to reprioritize our work, then we could bring the issue back to the board at a later date. Are there any members of the public who would like to address the board?
Currently, I'm not seeing any hands being raised.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's move on to our next informational item, Proyecto Fronterizo de Educación Ambiental, PFEA. I don't know if that's how you call it, PFEA? The Binational Coastal Water Quality Monitoring Lab. And we have Margarita Diaz with us to make a presentation. And I would like to note that she was awarded the Coastal Community Defense Champion. So she is a champion. Thank you. Dave, do you have any way, do you want to start this or should we invite Margarita Diaz to start?
Yeah, Margarita has a presentation. Are you going to do it from your side, Margarita, or did you want us to do it for you? You started it already. Thank you very much. I just wanted to share with the board that this is an exciting update that she has for us. She has some data that PFEA has collected south of the border, and I think just an opportunity for us to work with them. I've already been pleased to submit a letter on their behalf in Gilda Bay for a Border 2025 grant. We hope that they're successful in. And I believe that Margarita is coming to ask for support, informal or formal, from the Water Board on lab certification and additional partnership opportunities. And so I'd like to give the platform over to Margarita to give us an update on her program and her lab work. I think you'll find that the data is both unfortunately very familiar and also yet refreshing that it's coming from another group than state agencies or the International Boundary and Water Commission. And I think there's a real opportunity here for continued information for the benefit of Tijuana residents as well as San Diego. So thank you very much, Margarita, for joining us today and happy to turn it over to you.
No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, to opportunity to be in this important meeting with all you, and thank you, David, for the space. Yeah, I want to talk about our program. I'm Margarita Diaz, Executive Director of Proyecto Fronterizo Educación Ambiental, and I'm going to talk about one program only. We are a nonprofit organization founded in 1991. We are now 30 anniversary, dedicated to influence environmental policy and involving the community in actions that raise awareness and protect the integrity of coastal and river ecosystems within the Tijuana watershed. We started our monitoring program, began in 2010 by becoming an active member of Waterkeeper Alliance. Waterkeeper Alliance, as all you know, is an organization dedicated to defending drinkable, fishable, and swimmable waters worldwide. And we are one of the 350 waterkeepers from 45 countries. We are Tijuana Waterkeeper. And we are pioneers here in this region in Baja California, because we are the first one to establish our own lab and start a program of citizen science and start monitoring our waters here in Tijuana and giving this systematic notice to the public about the health incident of the recreational areas. I'm going to show a little pictures. You asked for beautiful pictures. This is a little video. This is Tijuana. This is the border. You can see it looks so small, the border, and we are a shared area. This is El Faro side. This is another area. This is Playas de Tijuana community, the coastal community neighbor to Imperial Beach. It's another side that we monitor. And this last one, I like it because you can see the whole region, no border. You can see the estuary, San Diego on the back, in Imperial Beach in the back, and the community of Playas de Tijuana. There's some sites here we monitor. So we have a program since 2014. We have been monitoring five sites. This red dot is the treatment plan, the outfall of our treatment plan, the Mexican Punta Bandera treatment plan. And we decided to monitor up north, close to the border, so we can share information and compare the data from the US side and the Mexican side. Here's a creek, Cañada Azteca, that's a very important point. We have El Vigía, that is right south of the treatment plant, and then north of the treatment plant. And south, we have these two beaches, community, San Diego, San Antonio del Mar and Playa Blanca, where we are monitoring. So we have data south and north of our treatment plant. We designed from the beginning our protocol or quality assurance project plan, and has been reviewed by Waterkeeper Alliance and also the University of Baja California. And we have been working all these years with funding from the Foundation Environment Now has support our work. They support waterkeepers in the states, California State and Baja California. We do on the coastal line, we go into the water. We cannot use boats, so we do it on the coast. We use the index system, the same system that is used in the US. And we have been trained, and in charge of our lab is a chemical engineer. Her name is Fernanda Bosch, and she's the one who does the sampling and the monitoring, the analysis. Since 2014, we have been capturing this data, collecting data and analyzing by a weekly base. And we have 1,019 samples from 2014 to 2019. In as expected, 2020, we stopped the program because of the pandemic. And then 2021, we restarted, and we restarted every 2 weeks, the monitoring because of the pandemic and also funding. So we have 764 samples in this period because of the pandemic. It has been a very hard time getting the information. And I want to show you some graphics about this, our results. I'm going to start in 2015 into 16. These different colors are the different sites that we monitor. This red line indicates the number that is above that number, the beach has to be closed. And I want to do a note here, because in the state is 100, the most probable number in Terococos. But in Mexico is 200. So sometimes you can see in Swim Guide or in any other media, you can see that it's in the US side, it's maybe in red, and in Mexico is in green, because we have a difference of 100. But that's not the problem. We have bigger problems than that. And as you can see, like all the other sites north of the treatment plant are below this line. We have a very active beach. It's not like in zero. We have this activity in our coastlines. But we noticed with this monitoring something, and now the authority has assured us and accepted that something went wrong in 2015. As you can see, it was like fairly okay. And then here it just pop up, and here is not hundreds, it's thousands, it's like 7,000, 8,000. It went way up and it stayed up. The next year, it was the same. It was not controlled. It was all over the place. And the other sites were not clean, but they were below the acceptable measurement. 2017, also it was very, very difficult. Here's February, where all the issues that everybody known and Imperial Beach has noticed a lot. So all this year, it was very, very bad, and it kept going to 2018. In December of 2017, the government of Mexico closure of this area is San Antonio del Mar area and Malibu, and it was officially closed. They didn't put any signs or anything, but they closed it. It was only on paper. But we are very concerned, because it were higher. It was very, very high, 7,000, 8,000, 12,000, when the number is 200 and it states is 100. 2019, it was the same, but we have other beaches that were also going, we monitor two beaches, but also south of the treatment plant, north and south were impacted. So in Mexico, you have heard a lot of the US of Imperial Beach. Imperial Beach is in danger, Imperial Beach is closed, Imperial Beach, the people from Imperial Beach are in danger. Well, I'm saying that the people in Tijuana are way out in danger, and we are very, very concerned about that. And when we came back to monitor in 2020, it was high. This is the lowest and the highest, like the four times that we monitored, this is the numbers. It was way up. It didn't show in our, it was higher than that. In this year, we have these numbers. It's like a little lower, but it's way, way, way up. And now July is going down a little bit. Still about area. We publish the information every week. Every time we have it, 24 hours later, we put it on our Facebook. We put it on Swim Guide. We are part of the Comité de Playas Limpias. That's the government authority where they sit out at the table, federal, state, and municipality authorities with the community. They haven't, this administration didn't do a very good job. They didn't call for meetings. So we are very concerned also that. And we have been on the media like very, very often. In this 2018 and to 2019, we had the opportunity to work with Southern California Coastal Water Research Project. With this project that just, as David mentioned, it was last week just published. We worked with Amy Zimmer. She was our, here she is, and our team. And we were working to help them to gather the information in the Mexican side so we can have a more integrated data. So we talked to them, they came to our lab, they talked to our staff, and they said, yes, you have the requirements so we can work together. And we were helping them to gather the samples on site, and then we filtered the water, and then the filters were sent to the US for further analysis. So that's the way we were working with them. So it was a very interesting experience. We also had some working and collaborating with Scripps, and also where they throw the tide, the pink tide, we were working with them. We also, in this project, also about, we did this filtering. They gave us the equipment, then we turn it back. And we also make from bacteria our use analysis and gather, and we shared information with them. And it was also used for this research, so it was a very important thing. In the Mexican side, we have been, as you can see, our data, and it was showing that the treatment plan was not working. We were going out to the media. So what the government is saying that since we're not a certified lab, our data is not, they cannot use it, it's not worth it. And so we are pursuing to be the first citizen certified lab in the whole country, in Mexico. So we want to really, really, we are working hard to get this certification so we can keep on doing our work and keep on having this baseline about data, because we think that is important. And now that you saw all this project that is going back and forth, this $300 million that are going, and EPA and all the research, we have a lack of information in the Mexican side. We need a baseline with information to take these decisions, to see what's the best way to approach these things, what we're talking about and what is running on the river, and do it upstream of the river, up the watershed, and also in the coastline, to have this information that we can share, and it will be useful for decision makers. We started with some funding that we got from help from ICF, International Community Foundation, that are working with us also. Paloma Ramirez is our project manager. And we have a little piece of money, and we started working on the accreditation with this standard, the 17025. But we don't have enough funding to conclude this certification. Our staff, the people, we are really, really into getting this this level of expertise and having all this recognition to keep on doing this and have this very, very important piece of information that it will be data for decision making. And as a citizens working to inform the public about the water quality conditions, the FEA would like to respectfully ask for the partnership of the Water Board in support of our efforts to inform the public and with our efforts to achieve certification and funding for additional binational monitoring. And also will be a big help to have to work in coordination with the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project that we did this project, but we think we can do more. And as everybody is saying, like the funding, it's for both sides. The information is for both sides, and we are very committed to have the information up to date, public, in time, and be shared for both sides of the border. It doesn't matter. We want everybody to have this information and to use it because we are in a very, very difficult situation. And also we are in a very difficult situation because now, as David mentioned, there's movements in our authorities, the water authorities going from the state to the municipalities where they don't have enough resources. So we're very worried that we think that having the data and not stopping this monitoring will be very, very useful and a valuable information to move on and try to find solutions in both sides of the board. Thank you. We want to stop this, not having this information on hand. Thank you very much,
Arquitecta Margarita Diaz. What is your shortfall? You said you have some money, it's not enough. How much money do you need to pursue the certification?
80,000.
And is that over what time frame? Immediate, over 2 years?
Immediate. Uh-huh. Because we started, will be like, so we don't stop. And like, if we have the resources, we can be certified like in 8 months. Uh-huh. If we got the resources.
Well, data is really important and your work is really important and we all need to work together to see how we can improve the situation. Executive Officer Gibson, are there any avenues we can recommend that might assist in identifying the 80,000?
Yes, thank you. We've encouraged them to continue working with SQIRP. It might be possible that SQIRP can arrange for some sort of a support, interlab support, either through funding or through services. We can also elevate the question to CalEPA, who may be able to access funding, which is more flexible than anything the state board or regional board certainly has. I will continue to support their efforts through funding requests, as I did with the Border 2025 grant request. So there may be opportunities there. And then finally, we talked about that we have not finalized an agreement with Four Walls International on solid waste management at the border. There is a possibility for institutional partnership at that level going forward. I wish I had a checkbook for $80,000 because it would be a worthwhile investment for both countries to have another avenue of information for the public to understand the quality of beach water. But we don't have that available. But those are avenues that I'm happy to pursue on behalf of the board in partnership with PAFIA.
And I, too, will look at private philanthropic opportunities to see if there's anything that might be brought to the table.
Thank you.
So, Chair Cantu,
go ahead.
Yeah, Chair Cantu, if there are no board member questions, we should ask if there are any public speakers who would like to address the board on this or on the previous information item as well, just to make sure that we're giving people the chance to speak up and communicate with us through what is sometimes a difficult platform.
Thank you.
Are there any board member questions, perhaps, we can address while the public is queuing up, if any?
I think your presentation, Roger, was very thorough and complete.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity. And
don't go away yet. We may have somebody from the public who might want to ask you a question.
Okay, I will.
Or a board member.
Board Chair Cantu, I am not seeing any.
We have one hand raised from Paloma here.
Yes.
Ah, we have a hand. Oh, Paloma Aguirre, please ask your question or make your statement. You have the floor, Paloma.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Now we can.
Oh, thank great. You for joining. Sorry about that. I kept trying to unmute. Thank you so much for the opportunity to give in to Proyecto Fronteriza to present on their wonderful program. It's more, I'm speaking more of in terms of a comment. I'd love to encourage the board to just continue to be open and to exploring the opportunities for binational collaboration. I think that now more than ever, it is so needed, especially with all the challenges that we're facing on both sides of the border, but particularly near the shoreline, the shared shoreline between Mexico and the US. So again, I think that it would be amazing if the board would consider, you know, whether it's a resolution or just even a statement of binational collaboration would be wonderful. So thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. We'll work on those opportunities. We'll work on the what possibilities we'll be able to do.
Thank you so much, Chair.
Last call for the public or board members to ask questions or make comments. And let's formally ask members of the public if they had any questions for the San Diego Park River Park Foundation. These would be comments or questions on the previous presentation.
There are no hands being raised.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Okay, we have finished our presentations and we're now at number 7, board members' requests for future agenda items. Do we have any board member requests for future agenda items? I see some hands. Henry Abarbanal.
Yes, thank you. The discussion of the drought and sustainability in the San Diego region reminded me that we have not met with the County Water Authority for some years. Dave Gibson and I were there, how long ago, Dave? 4 or 5 years ago?
It was probably a couple of years at most recently, at least, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, the County Water Authority, I think, is to be congratulated for their incredible efforts in making our region sustainable in terms of water supply, not to mention water quality. And I would like to have, as Dave suggested, a meeting with them to find out how we can be supportive of their efforts. And I'm talking about the desal plant in particular. It was alluded to that all earlier that our water supply is under threat. That may be true for the Colorado River in Northern California. Those are their traditional sources. But the future actually looks quite different, and the County Water Authority is ahead of the curve on that. And I'd like to suggest that we discuss with them what might seem like an implausible idea, and that is there are many infrastructure, there's many kinds of infrastructure that have been built to bring water from the Colorado River region and Northern California to us in this region. And if the county, the San Diego region, were to develop desal plants far beyond the Poseidon plant. And to give you an idea of the magnitude of the Poseidon plant, it now supplies 1 out of 5 residents in San Diego County with clean water. That's a lot. Anyway, if we expand the desal plants, the question is, could we use the existing infrastructure to sell that water to Nevada, Arizona, and others suffering enormously from the drought in the Colorado River basins, western and Central. So that's my suggestion, to meet with CWA and talk about things like this.
Thank you. Dr. Betty Olson's next.
Yes, I wanted to see if we could have a briefing in the board, because the state board just passed the framework and strategy for fresh harmful algal blooms. I guess it's a strategy for monitoring and the strategy and monitoring assessment. So is that possible that we could schedule that? They passed this in July. So maybe next year sometime, or.
Yeah, I think that there's probably staff who could make such a presentation. I don't know, scheduling, would have to coordinate scheduling, but that's something that we can look into for sure.
Yes, thank you, Chair Cantu. In response to both of those, first of all, in the executive officer's report, Dr. Olson, there is an update on freshwater harmful algal blooms and staff's work on that. So I think we can follow up on that at a later board meeting, perhaps in December, on something like that, a more detailed update or a chance to talk with other experts in the field by invitation. And to Henry's request, yes, indeed, I have already thought that would be one of the key agencies we'd be asking to meet with, is the San Diego County Water Authority, although you've come up with better ideas than I had about what we might talk about. So I will be very happy to include them as well.
Well, thank you. I realized that I forgot to mention that we should hear from the City of San Diego Clean Water Program to see how they are proceeding. That's another very ambitious project to assure sustainability in our region.
Yes.
Thanks, Dave.
Dave, I would like to mention, I did read the report and I saw the pictures of the dead carp. And one of the reasons why I asked for this is because obviously drought will intensify these impacts.
Indeed.
And temperature. I mean, we're seeing eutrophication and algal blooms just so many places that we never expected to see it in the past. So it's definitely another expression of climate change that we will have to deal with somehow. Okay, well, this brings us to the end of our meeting. Last call for any announcements or comments before we adjourn. Thank you very much for your attention and insights and the public's participation. And I wish all of you a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you.